Hello again, friends. And you are my friends. And welcome to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast. The only podcast on Turner Time. Yeah, we're still doing this. We haven't given up yet. I am the great Brian Lass, and with me as always...
Well, that was pointed.
The co-host with the most, Mr. David Bixenspan. Bix, our show's actually doing well. We're getting like tons of new listeners every week. What's going on? What's happening?
I don't know. I'm just starting to get perturbed that I'm the co-host and not you're that... Whatever.
You're getting perturbed. Your tongue is so angry you can't speak. I don't know what's going on over there. A few things to start with here is I think we're going to start up with some follow-ups. And this has been the biggest week in PBA Diaz news in a while, would you say?
Yes, since really the first month or so.
Yeah, I mean, we've referenced him here and there. And I think I've used PBA Diaz as now a verb to explain jumping on one's head. Mm-hmm. But we haven't actually spoken much. We haven't had any breaks in it. I think the last thing we had heard was people on Twitter suggesting that he was a ripoff of a soccer player, and then someone else jumped in and said, you're wrong, it's a different soccer player, and that's where we left it. Well, this happened only yesterday from our recording date. Someone on Twitter named Sean Paul, either Sean Paul or Jean Paul, yeah. Not quite sure. He sent me a couple of links. He'd done some investigating on his own. He said, look at this. And wouldn't you know it, here are a couple old websites in Spanish. I had it translated because Google is our friend. And it appears that PBA Diaz, the second PBA Diaz's real name is Hugo Quiril, Q-U-I-R-I-L. And I'm going to try to read some of this. It doesn't make much sense because the Google translator only does so much. But his career began at 21 when, with the help of a friend of his father, who was Don Quixote in Titanus and El Ring, I took a test to enter the program. Quiril practiced martial arts since the age of 5, and his skill was in the group of fighters in the cycle. That was how he was training, even at the hands of William Boo, until the summer of 1983, who made the PBA Diaz Kardashian, went on vacation, and this is reading like Jimmy Snuka saying it.
Yeah, right? I think we may need to give up on actually trying to read this. So, I know you read over the machine translation. You had an assisted human translation. Why don't you give the gist of this as opposed to getting a PBA Diaz macho business donkey wrestler?
The gist of this is that he jumped on his head.
And really?
He had a concussion and he was knocked out for a few seconds. And then he left Titanus and O-Ring in 85. And then he worked as an extra in a few movies. And he has an IMDb page. And he is a stunt coordinator in 20 films and an actor in 6 films. You may know him from the hit film or the hit series, Brigada Cola. He played Brigacop. And he also, on the TV series, now, is this a wrestling show? We don't know. Lucha Fuerte, he played Cato, El Gran Ninja Blanco.
Okay, Lucha Fuerte, I believe, is one of the Titanes in El Ring. I don't know if ripoff is the right word. One of the Titanes-esque promotions. I don't remember if it's another one from Argentina, though, or if it's from elsewhere in South America, and he would have traveled there. But it's the same basic idea.
Was Titanes still running at that time?
Oh, I don't know. I'm trying to remember if any of those groups were like opposition groups or if they were just knockoffs. I don't know. That's one of those things where, I mean, maybe ask Kurt Brown. Maybe it's in the bio that he did of Martin Caradagian, which is, by the way, on WrestlingObserver.com for subscribers. I believe it's the first Hall of Fame issue that's on the site.
Okay. And I will try to have Susie go through this thing with a fine tooth comb because she speaks Spanish and this thing's a mess. And the other thing, speaking of PBA Diaz's and Spanish, is someone also sent me a video of the first PBA Diaz, the one with all the dancing cocaine women.
Yes.
And it's him at a Titanus and O-Ring convention speaking.
From when? Recently?
From within the last 5 or 6 years, I think. I don't remember the date, but he's now bald. He's now completely bald. Mm-hmm. And again, I think we may have to have that translated. I believe it was the same person who sent it to me, and he tried to run it through a translator, and that didn't work. So we have some clues on the whereabouts of the various different PBA Diaz's, and we will keep you updated and stay on top of this breaking story here on 605, the Super Podcast.
You know what? On a related note, we should point out, we did learn, I don't think it's in our audio that we have coming up later. We did learn that Lupus is alive.
Yes. Oh, very good point, Bix. We talked a few weeks ago about a video I put up that I shot years ago at a Dennis Carluzzo show, three-way ladder match for the NWA 2000 Heavyweight Championship between Lupus, Twiggy Ramirez, and Kevin Knight. And in that match, my old friend Lupus took a dive off the ladder. The ladder gave way, and he did a header onto the floor. It was a very, very gruesome scene, very scary scene. He ended up being airlifted to a hospital trauma unit. And we had heard from Tom Robinson, I think, that he thought Lupus was dead. And you thought it made sense because that they used a fake Lupus in TNA when Raven had his flock reunite. Is that correct?
Right. Not necessarily that he was dead, but that no one could find him.
Okay. Well, according to Rick Ratchett, who we will speak to later on in the show in our Dentist of the Week, Lupus is alive and well and prosperous and having a really nice life. So it's good to hear that.
Well, and in contact with Raven, which means that making Sam Shaw into the fake Lupus was probably a rip.
Yeah. Well, that Raven is a funny guy. He's a funny, funny guy. I remember years ago, it may have been the weekend of the NWA 50th anniversary show, maybe 99, either 98 or 99. And a bunch of us were in Philadelphia. We said, hey, let's get out of here. And we took my car, and it was me, Mark Carluzzo, Donnie B, and Kevin Lawler, and it may have been Lupus. There was a fifth person there. And we ended up going to like a Hooters in Philadelphia because, you know, we were young and silly, and that's where you go. You go to Hooters. Mm-hmm. And there was this really cute waitress. And, you know, they're trained to flirt with you somewhat. It's like a stripper. But she was flirting. You know, she was very flirtatious. So everyone was like, someone has to get her to the show tonight. Psst. You know, you ask her, you ask her. And then finally, you know, it was like, last, you ask her. And, you know, I had to try to act like the man. So so I said to her, I'm like, hey, listen, I don't know if you like wrestling, but, you know, we're part of the wrestling company. We're doing a show tonight at the Marriott or whatever it was in Philadelphia by the airport or by the stadium, wherever the hell it was. Would you like to come to as our guest? We'll comp you. You can come down, bring a couple of your girlfriends. We'll have a good time. And she goes, oh, I know a wrestler, Raven.
Oh, boy.
And Donnie B perked up right away. He goes, oh, Scotty. Scotty's my friend. Scotty's a really good friend of mine. He works with my brother. And she goes, oh, yeah, Raven. I was at a strip club one night and because my friend was stripping and some guy was just like sitting back and throwing tissues at my breasts. And I said, who is that guy? And they're like, he's a famous wrestler. He's Raven. So I started talking to him. And then, you know, we got together. We got together and we hung out a bunch of times. And we started talking more. And then I kind of wanted to continue the conversation and get her to the show. I was like, that's so cool. You dated Scotty. And she goes, well, I didn't date him. I mean, I did him, but I didn't date him. And
I would have expected a little bit more. I don't know what the word would be. Decorum, tact, something from a Hooters waitress that seems more stripper level.
That's right. And then after we left Hooters, we got into a high-speed chase through the streets of Philadelphia. But that's a story for another time, a very scary story for another time. But on another follow-up from last week.
Well, no, I have to ask you a question.
Uh-oh.
Since I have never asked you this before, I was explaining its existence to someone who's not from around where we're from. Were you ever at the one strip club around here, because I've never been, Bare Necessities?
Oh, no. Okay. Oh, no. Whenever I've been to strip clubs, it's been really classy places or like in Montreal, which is just, you know, you go there to have a wild time. But Bare Necessity was like, when I was growing up in Long Beach, it was the place known as having toothless strippers.
Yes, that's always what I heard too. The reason I ask is because I was always fascinated by how it was misspelled, but it wasn't. if you saw the sign, you would think it was a strip club of hairy gay men because it was spelled B-E-A-R.
Yeah, that's actually very funny. And you know what's even funnier? When they thought that their business was going down, not because of the toothless strippers, but because of the brand, they rebranded themselves as simply The Bear.
Yes.
Which again, I don't know if they understood who their target market was. But anyway,
briefly to explain to people, this is the, like, every, from the exterior, every hole-in-the-wall strip club you've ever seen in your life, only smaller.
Yeah, it was a dump. I never went in there, luckily, but...
Me neither, and now it doesn't exist anymore, and thankfully.
Yeah, well, anyway, another follow-up from last week. We'll follow up on the Bear next week. Another follow-up is Coco Ware versus the Patriot. And That got a hell of a reaction, and we are actually now attempting to get Coco on the show. Fingers crossed. Please keep us in your prayers at night. But we're trying to get Coco on the show to talk about this, and really we want to talk about his entire career pre-WWF, because Coco Ware was pretty awesome in Memphis. He had a really good run in the UWF, but even before then, he was pretty good in the UWF or Mid-South back then with Norvell as the PYTs, taking their Memphis team there. Yep. And he also worked for Nick Goulas. So, I mean, I'm sure he has plenty of good stories.
Trained and broke in with a honky-tonk man.
That's right.
I'm sure he's got lots of stuff. Plus, even if it wasn't our preference, he is, well, being sued by WWE right now. So.
Right, but we don't intend to talk to him about that, although I have a feeling Bix is going to quiz him about that off air. But anyway.
No, why? Stop it.
But anyway, so we're working on getting Coco on the show, but, and I hope this doesn't deter Coco if he hears this, we talked to Rick Ratchett this week. You'll get to know Rick Ratchett later in the show a little better. He worked for Dennis. All the years I was around Dennis Carluzzo shows, Rick Ratchett was one of Dennis's top guys, one of the nicest guys around. I used to have so much fun hanging out with him. And we asked him in our interview with him, and it won't be there, it'll be right here. We said, you know, did you ever have any problems with any wrestlers in the ring? And wouldn't you know who won the pony? This is what he had to say. Do you have it ready, Bix?
Yep.
You mentioned you worked a lot of the old guys. I remember you working Honky Tonk Man in Vineland. I remember you working Georgie Animal Steel. Who was the worst of those guys to work with? Who just wasn't cooperative and just wasn't having it?
Oh, fuck. You know what, dude? Coco Beware was the worst one.
Really?
That doesn't surprise us as we tell
you. Oh, it doesn't? I don't know him that well. So, I mean, I didn't know him that well, but, man, I went in the ring and I talked to him in the back. He's like, yeah, we'll go out there and have a good time. This motherfucker didn't take a bump to his knees. Like, and then he just took like liberties on me, and he's outside the ring and he fucking potatoes me, and I'm like, what the fuck? Like, should I just hit the guy? I don't give a fuck. You know what? Beat me up and I'll go to the locker room afterward and shake your hand and say, good job. You know, because I went back to the locker room and I told him, I said, boy, you really had the crowd into that one. That was some good psychology, brother. And I just walked.
Was that a magical moment or what? What timing we have.
Oh, I mean, when he said that, you know, we talked about all the different wrestlers that he had worked with who had been names, and like, was anyone bad? When he said that, it was like, oh my god. The timing, what amazing. So listen, if you're a wrestler and you've been beaten up by Coco Ware, write to David Bixenspan, care of Long Beach, New York 11561.
Oh boy,
I hope you get like letters and videos like, look what he did to me. Mid-South, 84. So, well, on that topic, I did want to talk about a couple other things.
Yes.
We have our Facebook page. It is facebook.com/superpodcast. And please join us on there. It's a fun little community. We try to always get back to you when you have questions or comments. And some really cool things have been posted. And I want to, before we go any further, I want to give a major thanks to Travis Heckle. He's on Twitter at Memphis History. He posts cool Memphis stuff all the time, so you should follow him. But he's been making custom artwork for us, and we've been showcasing it on our Facebook page. And the Coco Ware reminded me of it because he did a custom artwork, which was our banner, and it will be again. We're going to rotate him in and out, of the Patriot after Coco Ware beat him up. And he's been doing lots of really cool artwork for our show, and I know I've written it to him, but I want to make sure we say it here on the air how appreciative I am and Bix is for him doing it, and it's great stuff, isn't it, Bix?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Travis is awesome, and that's also one of my favorite things that just in all of this, even though it wasn't on the show, it was on Between the Sheets, that you told the whole, all the fan week stuff, and then later, well, we told some of it on here with the Master of Sex thing, and then it turns out you met him in a convenience store randomly 21 years ago.
Yeah. That is like amazing. And he's this artwork. I mean, my favorite one, maybe the one he just did of the Macho Man, the classic Macho Man shirt, where instead of Macho Man, it just says, you got to go, you know, play on that classic story I told last week of my one confrontation with a angry Randy Savage.
As if there's any other kind.
Yeah, you don't hear too many. I mean, I shouldn't say that. Mike Francesa, who I listen to all the time and have since I was a kid, a sports talk show host here in New York. When Macho, he hates wrestling. Whenever wrestling comes up, he's like the typical guy, like, well, why do you like wrestling? You know, and then he starts talking about what he remembers when he was a kid that he liked. Why do you like wrestling? You know, I used to watch Bruno Sammartino and Bobo Brazil and Gorilla Monsoon, but it's not like that anymore. But when Macho Man died, all of a sudden he talked about wrestling and he goes, I got to tell you, nice guy. Macho Man Randy Savage, nice guy. I met him at a charity softball game and nice guy. We had a good talk and it was like the first time he ever said anything positive about wrestling on his show. If you've never listened to Mike Francesa, he's a complete know-it-all, entertaining in being that, but he's a complete know-it-all. He's kind of like a heel Gorilla Monsoon commentator. Like how Gorilla Monsoon knows everything and shoots you down. He's like that, except he's like a New York heel version of that. That's the best way I could put it.
If you're not from New York, he's the guy who you've seen the clip of falling asleep on the air.
Yeah, that is the most well-known clip of him. That and him screaming at the Jets reporter. But anyway, Travis Heckle, thank you so much for all the work you've done. We really appreciate it, and we really look forward to the future and what other stuff you'll be sending us to pop us, and you do every time. Also on our Facebook page, got a few listener comments and questions. Eric Darcy, you know, whenever I hear Brian talk, for half a second I think it's Captain Lou talking. Haha. Is there any way Brian could sing the ending of Captain Lou by NRBQ where Lou goes all crazy and such? I'm not going to sing the ending of that song. I will say that I love that song. And, you know, one of the lines that Lou uses in the end of that song when he's going crazy is a line I use in life. I just throw it into things and watch people's reaction. And that is psychedelic pandemonium. I just sometimes will say that like whenever I'm doing something and people are like, what's that? And I can't tell you, you know, the best thing about the Captain Lou song is something friend of the show, Scott Cornish, sent me years ago. And it is something I've seen on YouTube. And every time it goes up, it's down right away. And I think it's down right away because Uncle Floyd himself pulls it down. But NRBQ was on the Uncle Floyd show in, I think, 82 with Captain Lou.
Whenever the Lou and the Q album came out. And you hipped me to this years ago.
I think it's 82, though, yeah. Right? I mean, that makes sense.
You want me to look up Lou and the Q? I will do it right now.
Look it up while I tell the story. So Uncle Floyd has Captain Lou and NRBQ on. And before NRBQ lip syncs their song, Captain Lou, Captain Lou's just doing a Lou Albano crazy interview when he was still drinking vodka. So it's great. And then the band starts playing. Now, during the song, the only parts Lou says are Captain Lou, Captain Lou, Captain Lou. And then at the end of the song, there's a part where he's just like ranting and raving, obviously in the studio, drunk off his ass. Here's the problem. The song is Captain Lou. Most of the lyrics are Captain Lou. Captain Lou himself doesn't know the song or the lyrics. So when he's supposed to be lip syncing, he just moves his mouth and makes his eyes really wide. So
even though the lyrics are Captain Lou, Captain Lou, Captain Lou.
He doesn't know when they come in. He doesn't know what to say. And at the end, when it's just all the gibberish, he's just moving his mouth and waving his arms around. And it's one of the funniest clips in the history of the world. And every time I want to show it to someone, every time I've seen it on YouTube, it gets pulled down right away. I have it on video somewhere because Scott Cornish gave it to me. But I need the world to see this.
Okay. Discogs.com says 1985, which sounds wrong.
No, that's absolutely 100% wrong.
If we look at Wikipedia for NRBQ.
And for those of you,
Wikipedia says Lou and the Q is 1986. Did they have a single maybe before the album?
It could have been.
Okay.
It could have been. But for those of you who've heard the song on the wrestling album, this is the original version of that played by NRBQ. And NRBQ's, I think he was playing guitar at the time. It wasn't because Joey Stampinato was the bass player. Al Anderson was the guy who later on was playing in and sang with my bass. Or he didn't sing it, but he was when Jeff Jarrett and the Road Dogg were doing with
the
my
guy with the beard.
Tonight. Yeah, he was the big guy playing along with them. That's Big Al Anderson from NRBQ.
That's right. I forgot about that.
So that's that in terms of follow up. Next question we got is a follow up. Hey guys, in this week's show, you were wondering what happened to Mad Maxine after she left the World Wrestling Federation, but before she showed up in the UWF. I just happened to be watching Battle of the Belts 1 from 85, and there she is as Miss Maxine with Coco Samoa. So it looks like she spent some time in Florida. So I actually didn't remember that. So Battle of the Belts 1 would have been 85 in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think I knew she was in Florida. Maybe I'd have. Or am I thinking of when we heard about this after we recorded last week's show?
She really got classy because she went from Mad Maxine to Miss Maxine to Lady Maxine.
She's
a lady. So there's Mad Maxine. And then Shane McClure asked an interesting one. I got hooked on pro wrestling around 82 watching Southeastern Championship Wrestling with Charlie Platt hosting. Do you guys have any plans to do an in-depth show on Southeastern? Also, Why was Jody Hamilton calling himself the Flame in Southeastern while still wearing his assassin mask? That has always perplexed me. One thing I'll say is we will always talk about Southeastern because it's something we both enjoy and we'll mix it into the show. But you should expect a large segment about it right around the time Bo James puts out his book about East Tennessee wrestling history. I feel like that's a good time to have a really good long talk about it. He's an expert in the field. So we will definitely be covering it around that time. Bix, why was Jody Hamilton the Flame in Southeastern?
Jody Hamilton was the Flame in Southeastern because there had been fake assassins. I think one of them was Randy Colley, and it didn't do well. And I think he even said in his book something like they assassinated the gimmick in that territory. So he came in as the Flame. I mean, he's still basically the same character. It's not the same mask unless he didn't use the same mask early on. It's different coloring. It's the red trim instead of black trim, and same basic. You know, there's not really a gimmick. He's just, you know, he's a mask guy with a name that cuts promos like Jody Hamilton. And then later he lost like a Loser Leaves Town match or whatever it was, and he became El Fuego, who was a completely different person from the Flame.
Yeah, they all suspiciously sounded just like the assassin.
Yes, and then later, like,
he's the most distinctive voice.
When he's running his promotion, like when he's running Deep South and stuff and doing Pro Wrestling This Week and all that with Joe Pedicino, there was an Pro Wrestling This Week storyline or on the Superstars block or whatever about trying to pretend that the Flame and the Assassin were different people. And then finally, like, he's calling a Flame match as the Assassin with Pedicino, and they're like, you see, well, I mean, the Flame... That whole thing, and then Pedicino calls him out, and of course their relationship did not end well.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen the thing that Hamilton talks about in his book? I have not. I think I've asked Chris Elner about it. I think he has seen it, where he did just this like heavy-handed, mean-spirited parody of Joe Pedicino and Bonnie Blackstone on his TV.
No.
He talks about in this book that it's like, I think it's one of his sons, maybe Nick Patrick, in a fat suit or with the indie wrestling equivalent of a fat suit being a pillow and a wig, and someone is Bonnie getting makeup pancaked all over and stuff like that because saying that, you know, she needed that to look good on TV, something like that. And then according to Hamilton, Pedicino showed it to Brody, explaining how it had, you know, it was kind of upsetting and blah, blah, blah. And Brody laughed. And Hamilton claimed that Pedicino said something like, well, how would you feel if that made your son cry? And he claimed that Brody, like, had a not a kind of smart ass reply to that. I'm not sure if I believe that version of the story, but there you go.
Man, you know, one of the things that always perplexed me was, remember in 93 when all of a sudden the Assassin was on WCW television again?
Yes.
And he would confront Dusty Rhodes and he would just go, you know, they'd go back and forth. And then he would go, you know, just one thing, Dusty Rhodes, ask your mama. And he would walk away and Dusty would act all mad, like, you know, what does he mean by that? And it happened like a few times and they never explained what it meant. It was like one of those classic Dusty Rhodes things where it just nothing is ever explained.
I don't know, photos of Dusty's mama in a manila envelope.
Yeah, you see, maybe that was actually the conclusion of the baby doll angle. And they didn't explain that part either.
I thought that was supposed to be a black woman. Wait, maybe Dusty's mother is? Okay.
Wow, Bix. You know, what? Just when I think I know you, you take it to another level.
What?
No, I'm kidding. Okay. But anyway, Facebook.com/superpodcast. Jump on there. We'd love to hear from you. Join our growing community. And yeah, let's have some fun.
And by the way, I will give, of course, our buddy Chris Elner a plug because I believe he has announced that, you know, I know he did, that he is doing a Continental episode of Exile on Bad Street soon.
Oh, there you go. When it's up, we'll let everyone know.
And of course, we'll be doing our own thing too, like you said, with Bo. And but we love Continental. I'm sure we'll be talking about it all the time.
Yeah. So Mark Nolte died this past week. For those of you who don't know, Mark Nolte would be best known as running the Wrestling Classics website. It's a forum that's, I think, a valuable resource, especially for historians who want to do research on, you know, older wrestling like Luthez, mm-hmm. But I always thought it was a – I've been visiting for years. I very rarely post, but it's a fun forum. I enjoy reading it, and it's a nice little community there. And he died, and, you know, I think everyone pointed out, you know, here is Mark Nolte from Wrestling Classics, and, you know, Dave Meltzer did a nice piece about him, talking about how influential he was in, like, the early days of The Observer.
Yep.
And, you know, he's someone I remember seeing, like, a Mark Nolte Texas newspaper column about world-class wrestling in, like, I don't know, the end of 83 or early 84 in The Observer. Like, it was an actual reprint of the column. But, you know, it made me think of something. Mm-hmm. You know, do you remember the movie The King of Kong?
Yes, of course. Great movie.
With Steve – oh, fantastic documentary. Steve Wiebe is trying to have his Donkey Kong high score validated, but this the greatest heel in the history of documentaries, Billy Mitchell. Oh my God, he's amazing. He's like using all of his influence and political power to squash Steve Wiebe. Well, after that movie came out, and I loved it, I found another movie called Chasing Ghosts. Did you ever see that one?
Yes.
And Chasing Ghosts is about all the early video gamers. It's based around, like, there was a famous photo in Life magazine.
The competitive gamers, yeah.
Yeah, well, the arcade gamers, I guess, to be really firm with that. There was a photo in Life magazine, and it may have been 82 or 81, probably 82. And it was like the top video gamers in the world, or the top arcade players in North America, because they had people from Canada come, and, you know, like Donkey Kong, Asteroid, like all the high score guys in this one photo. And they were there for a weekend, you know, tournament. And it shows you what happened to them and where they are now. So it shows you, like, the little bit of fame they had. And then when the arcade business crashed, how they lost all their, like, endorsements and all the things that people were trying to build up around this growing industry went away. Right. And then it shows you where they are now. And it just made me think, and it's something we've talked about a little bit before, Bix, but, you know, there's this first class, this early generation of inside fans. Mm-hmm. And I know there were newsletters in the early 70s and even the 60s. But to me, it all starts with, like, that late 70s period, like the WFIA, you know, like when you hear that, like, Cornette and Eddie Gilbert, and, you know, you hear, like, Norm Dooley, Cornette's friend, who was trading tapes back then. Right. And, you know, like, out of Florida, you had Pete Lederberg and Barry Rose. Like this first class of wrestling insiders who were smart, in communication with each other, trading tapes with each other, getting newsletters, writing into the newsletters. And it's like it starts there, and it kind of ends, I would say, almost like either, you know, late 80s or early 90s when people were traveling to shows. Like in 89, you hear about all these fans that were going to, like, every WCW pay-per-view.
The WCW pay-per-view deadheads.
Is that what they're called?
Yes.
That's very apropos. But, you know, so it's a fascinating era that I don't feel is documented enough. Like, the wrestling is, but the actual inside scene isn't. You know, an inside scene that would lead to the development of the Wrestling Observer newsletter, which was the game changer, really. Because that's the one that, you know, brought newsletters into the locker room. And, you know, as Jim Cornette said on our show, he saw that newsletter and he realized it wasn't just a newsletter. This guy knows what he's talking about. And, you know, Dave had connections. Dave was talking to Brody. Dave was talking to the Mid-South office. Dave was talking to everyone. At a, you know, one point or another. You're talking to McMahon, actually.
Didn't Watt actually at some point in, like, 85 or 86 actually tell everyone on the roster to start subscribing to The Observer?
Is that true? I never heard that.
I've heard that before. I'm trying to remember where I heard that originally. I honestly don't remember where I heard that originally. That's one of those things I've heard going back years.
So, yeah, I mean, that's what the death of Mark Nolte kind of triggered in me. It's just this thought, like, you know, because he's part of that group, and the guys who would, you know, go to a WFIA convention.
Yeah.
Or the guys who would write into The Observer, the guys who were subscribing to The Observer in 83. And I don't know,
right.
Biggs.
Who are these people who are subscribing to The Observer when it starts, right?
Right, right. And, you know, these are the people who are watching Japanese tapes and are getting the territories on tape. These are the first group of people who are seeing wrestling from all different parts of the country and around the world.
Yeah, and it's like, it's so weird for me. Like, I feel kind of like, I feel jealous of being able to see that as it happens, even if it's still on a delay. You know, it's still different. That it's like to be part of that just as it's taking shape. You know what I mean? It's like, oh my God, now I'm seeing this and I'm seeing this. And I can only imagine what the people who were based out of New York thought when they started seeing every single other territory.
Yeah, you know, it's like we talked to Jim Cornette about when he first saw Tiger Mask and how it blew him away.
Right.
That's why I always love that Tiger Mask Dynamite Kid match from The Garden, just because you could actually hear the crowd getting turned on. You know, like you could hear them.
They're buzzing. They're not necessarily popping at first, but they're like, they're talking to each other. It's like, what the heck is this?
And then they start popping because they've never seen anything like that. And, you know, they wouldn't really ever again at the Garden. I mean, you know, I shouldn't say that, but.
But come on, let's be real. WWF wrestling was terrible.
Right. But that during that period, there was good stuff.
No, there's good stuff throughout the 81, 82 period. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, even after that, though, you know, like the Cobra and the Black Tiger was at MSG.
Yeah.
I mean, so it wasn't like the only high flying match they saw there is my
point. No, of course not. Yeah.
But yeah. So, I mean, it's just this thought that, you know, there's no documentation of it. There's no documentation of the first group of smart fans, you know, to put a label on them. That got together and really created this underground industry, whether they knew it or not. You know, the tape trading and, you know, what are now the message boards. You know, I was at the very end of it because, you know, in 94, when I started up with this kind of stuff, it was, you know, I was doing tape parties still. You know, tape parties were still around.
You're the very end of the pre-internet generation in terms of when you got started. Me, yes. I'm the very beginning of the internet generation in terms of when it really exploded in terms of tape trading and all that. And tape trading message boards. Because there were people tape trading on news groups and stuff before I got online. But for me, yeah, I mean, you know, I got online in like 97 and then I got a second VCR in 98.
You know, we have to do something. I mean, you and I have both tried to get Dave Meltzer on the show and he has so far been hard to get a hold of. If anyone wants to tell Dave to come on the show, please feel free. But we should do something about this. Maybe get Pete Lederberg or someone on the show to talk just specifically about this topic.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much to go through with all this, and there's so many different angles. Just like there's the when did you first see other territories? What was the first other territory that you saw? Did you get audio tapes from other territories before you had a VCR? You know, going on trips to the WFIA convention and all that. You know, I'm trying to remember if we've talked about it on here before. No, I guess I'm thinking more for like on Between the Sheets, like that. I don't remember if we talked about it with Kurt Brown. I know I've talked to him about it in general. The all-time great stroke of luck was that the 1980 WFIA convention was not only in Atlanta, but in Atlanta the week of the Ole Anderson turn on Dusty.
Right. The 81 was in Atlanta for that. The 79 one was in Memphis for the Freebirds debut.
Yep.
And I don't know if anything happened in Knoxville the year before that. I don't know if anything big happened then.
Right. And then what was 81 was Houston, I think.
I think so. I think that's about right.
Yeah. And there's a lot to cover. I mean, I guess because we're not part of it, it's harder for us to really. But you get the idea.
Yeah. But I mean, again, like even Jim Cornette said, he went to the WFIA convention in Knoxville and, you know, there were all these fans who had a similar outlook on wrestling as he did. But then there were also just, you know, I hate to use the word marks, but, you know, the traditional mark, the people who believed, the people who didn't want to know otherwise. So it's like you had to navigate through those waters. And, you know, I say it created an industry. It created a scene. You know, all the tapes we have now from that period, from the late 70s, early 80s, are because someone taped it. And they were just lucky enough to be able to find someone in another area that taped wrestling there. And make a deal and trade it.
Right. Maybe they only had one VCR. Maybe they sent their copy.
Right. So, I mean, you know, think about, too, how many wrestling fans taped stuff off TV back then and didn't know anyone. They just taped it for their own personal enjoyment.
And they exist. I mean, there are people, you'll find them sometimes. Sometimes you'll be lucky enough to get a copy or convert it to DVD and then they'll disappear. I know because it's happened to me.
Yeah, Bo James says, like, people come up to him like, hey, I have, like, you know, I used to tape Southeastern off TV in, like, 79. He's like, what? Give it to me. I will pay you. So, this is something that we're going to definitely revisit. I'd like to get Dave Meltzer on to talk about it, but we'll see. He's a little hard to get a hold of for us. And you're one of his, like, writers.
Sort of.
Yeah. Me, I'm just a pain in the ass subscriber. But, so that's that. You know, a few weeks ago, was it a few weeks ago? I guess it was the Cornette episode, right?
What?
Where we talked about, like, what ifs, like the British Bulldogs in Mid-South or Randy Savage in Mid-South.
Yes.
I have another one. Okay. I saw years ago a Roddy Piper shoot interview. And again, it's Roddy Piper, so you never really know exactly what to believe. Not that he's inherently a liar, but he did a lot of drugs. And,
no.
You know, sometimes that, you know, changes the way you remember things. But I tend to believe this story. I don't remember if it was in Gary Hart's book too, but he said that one of the times he was blackballed, and quite frankly, I've never understood why he was blackballed twice. One of the times he was blackballed, he had nowhere to work, and Gary Hart calls him up and he's like, "Rod, I would like you to come work for me in Dallas." And Roddy was interested and he goes, "How much?" And Gary Hart said, $500 a week. And Piper shot it down because it was such a low amount of money. But that would have been 82. Imagine if Roddy Piper had been there in 82, right before the Freebirds got there, or right around the same time as the Freebirds. Just what that could have been.
Yes. Now, first of all, this did happen. Gary Hart talked about it in his book, that he did offer Piper a job when the whole blackballing thing was happening, and then it got settled. You know, there was the money thing, and then also got settled anyway, so it wasn't really an issue. Do we know when exactly in 82 this was?
I don't. Was Gary Hart booking the entire year?
Gary Hart was booking going back to 76.
No, but he was working in Georgia in 82 also. Was he booking
Dallas?
He was
working Georgia on weekends.
Okay.
But he was booking Dallas. He was booking Dallas from like 76 to 80 through – from like whenever he got back in 76 through when he left at the beginning of 83. He was the booker the whole time.
Well, that raises the question. Did Fritz really screw him on the December payoffs just to get rid of him? Did he have Ken Mantell there and want to have him there? Because why would you treat a guy like that if he's been your booker for – you know, the better – for what? 6 years? 8 years? What is that? 8 years?
Six or 7 years. But why would you even be – like, what? Why? Ken Mantell had no track record yet.
No.
He did do some good stuff, but I don't see why you would act – unless it's just Fritz being greedy. Gary Hart in his book kind of put it as, I think, Fritz just being greedy.
Hmm.
Which, I don't know. I mean, it seems like – that was a thing with Fritz to a degree, to say the least.
Yeah.
To a degree.
Allegedly.
So let's see. So we're – let's just say in the – so if he comes in and – here's the thing. If he comes in before the Freebirds, I think that's more the more interesting part. Does he come in before the Freebirds? And if he does, do the Freebirds happen? Or do you already have him as this big top heel?
Oh, see, that's interesting. Like, imagine if that cage match happens, but they bring Piper in as the babyface, and Piper's the one that turns on Kerry.
Exactly.
Oh, I mean, you know, like Fort Worth TV back then, there was no time limit on interviews either. It was just go out there and say whatever you got to say. It would have been amazing because that was prime Piper.
Yes, it would have been amazing in many ways. Not all of them good.
Yeah, no, he may not have survived if he had gone to Dallas in 82, quite frankly, with the partying scene there. Yeah, no, with the partying scene there and his abusive personality, he may not have been able to handle that.
Yeah, and then as far as, like, the Freebirds, like, how does he fit in, though, do you think, if he comes there, like, right around the time of the Freebirds? Because obviously Hart had that booked out already.
Well, here's the thing. So Freebirds come in late 82. They turn heel December 82. Now, the beginning of 83, you have Freebirds versus Von Erichs. And then shortly after that is when Jimmy Garvin comes in, right? And then they transition to Jimmy Garvin versus David Von Erich. And the Von Erichs and the Freebirds are still feuding. And then is it the summertime that Chris Adams comes in?
In 83? That sounds about right.
So, I mean, that's the thing. Let's say you still go with Von Erichs versus Freebirds. What top babyface would there be to work with Piper? Don't say Al Madrill.
Well, who was the secondary? Who was the top non-Von Erich babyface before Adams came in?
I don't know. Jose Lothario? I mean, seriously, who was – other than the Von Erichs, who was the next babyface there?
I don't know. I mean, you'd have to –
Brian Adias hadn't debuted yet, had he?
If he had, he doesn't count.
Of course, but the question had
to
be asked.
Yeah, I don't think there's anyone that – yeah, that is interesting. I've never really thought of it that way before, that they really didn't have anyone slotted in.
No.
And yeah, I guess I don't think you put Piper with the Freebirds. I mean, maybe you do a loose association between them like you had with a lot of the heels in World Class.
But see, they were strong on heels because, you know, Kamala, they had Kabuki there. Then they had Kamala come in. Brody was back by 83. I don't think he was there much in 82, right?
Yeah, Brody came back in as a semi-regular early 83, yes.
Yeah, so Brody comes back. Brody Piper, I don't think that would be a good fit.
for either of them.
No, that would not work. You know, the other interesting thing is obviously Piper's given the call well before the Freebird feud because he's offered $500 a week. And Dallas was considered at that time a really bad paying territory for everyone other than Devon Erics, I would assume, you know, even for their booker, as it turned out. So, I mean, imagine if the call came, if Piper was still looking for work a few months later when World Class had heated up. Like, let's say in 83, if he had been blackballed.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think, like, so who else, who comes in once the territory heats up in general? Like, when does Jimmy Garvin first come in?
That's early 83, because they do the gimmick where he comes in and Sunshine and him won't allow his matches to be on TV.
Right.
Because they study videotapes, but they don't want anyone to study his videotapes.
Right.
And by the way, that's the bet. Jimmy Garvin's amazing there in 83. He's so good.
Yes, Raw, we talked about a bad Jimmy Garvin recently. That's good Jimmy Garvin.
Look, Freebird Jimmy Garvin is awful in every possible way. But gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, up until he turns babyface, is awesome. Is all sorts of awesome.
And apparently a big draw among the female demographic.
What?
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was a Between the Sheets thing. I've never showed you this. Okay, so a while back, I was tipped off to that there is a huge archive online, searchable no less, of Broadcasting Magazine, the trade magazine that eventually became Broadcasting Cable. And yeah, I just tried to find all like the wrestling-related articles and stuff, and I have them all saved. And there are even ads in there, and there are a few from like, you know, NatP, which was the big syndication convention time each year. And the Crockett ads are about how NWA wrestling does better among women and maybe teens than the WWF. And the wrestler spotlight in the ads are Luger in one and Jimmy Garvin and Precious in the other.
I like gorgeous Jimmy Garvin. Megan. I don't think any women are like, oh, we got to get home on Saturday at 6:05 to watch gorgeous Jimmy. I think the only women saying that were his valets throughout the years.
Is now a good time to have the discussion of, as has been mentioned in, I think, at least one of the World Class documentaries, for some reason, much better on-screen romantic chemistry with his cousin than his wife.
Yeah, although I've said it before on this show, I think Precious is the most underrated, beautiful woman in wrestling history.
And just an underrated performer.
Yeah, she was great. She was really, really great. Sunshine never pops up, does she? She never goes to any conventions or reunions or anything?
No, I mean, that's kind of her thing that she disappeared. I mean, she still keeps at the whole secrecy thing, unlike Dark Journey, our good friend Dark Journey. Maybe that's for the better. I don't want to know about Sunshine's colonic business.
Yeah, you are.
Or
very
maybe we do.
I don't know about that. You know, the other one is, and I think it had been something rumored that some people wanted, but they understood why it didn't happen. But David Manning, I think, on his most recent appearance with Ric Flair on his podcast, said that, like, oh yeah, I wanted to bring the Road Warriors in to face Devon Erics in 85. And, you know, again, there's another, like, what if? What if
maybe
the Road
Warriors? Maybe you wanted to, but it wouldn't have.
No, but imagine, like, the Road Warriors, so 85, so they're in AWA 84. So maybe it was 84 then, because maybe it was right before they went to the AWA after Georgia. I'm not sure, but I think it may have been 85 that he said.
Either way, nobody's selling for anyone.
That's the thing. I mean, although, I, you know, just the geek in me would love to have seen the Road Warriors and Ellering in the Sportatorium, just like in that atmosphere with the screaming women and everything. It would have been awesome.
Yes. I'm trying to where, like, what are the biggest territories that they didn't work in when they were doing the touring thing?
The Warriors?
Yeah, besides Texas. Obviously, they didn't do WWF.
They did Memphis. They did Florida. They did, obviously, they were a long time in the AWA, a long time for Crockett Promotions.
They worked shots in Portland.
Did, okay, so they
I
worked.
I think they did.
Portland. I don't think they worked Savaldi, although he's not big in any sense.
Stampede, same thing. I mean, not a major territory.
Not Stampede, obviously All Japan.
Don't know about East Tennessee and Alabama.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think of that. I'm not sure. Mid-South, we know they did.
Yes. I mean, the East Tennessee and Alabama, it's considered a smaller territory because it's, I guess, geographically and because they had a small crew, but paid well.
Yeah.
So it's different, I feel like. It's more of a Portland than a Memphis, I guess you could say.
Yeah. So,
you know what? I'm surprised I've never heard that comparison before, but maybe it's because we've been learning more about the whole East Tennessee-Alabama thing. it's not brought up that much as much as a well-paying territory as it should be.
You know, it's a wrestling – it's a territory whose history has largely not been closely examined.
And that's changing.
And now we're at that point where it's changing. I mean, Bo James has just been doing great work getting his story and his research out there so people know that. I mean, someone writes something on Twitter like, oh, yeah, this guy was in a Continental in 78. And Bo will just be like, he wasn't in 78. He was there in 79. They were on this channel. This is what time they aired. You know, like he knows everything. He's got it down. It's so impressive. It's so impressive. Who else do you think would have been a good fit in world class during those peak years? Let's say from the end of 82 up until the Cotton Bowl 85.
I feel like I have to think of guys who were known for working stiff or at least looking like they work stiff, because that's kind of the Texas thing. Especially with the Von Erichs. I mean, Chris Adams sort of like had that snappy looking style, even if maybe he wasn't as like stiff in a good or bad dangerous way.
What about Terry Taylor? What about like 85 Terry Taylor if he went there as either a babyface or what we'd later see in Texas, him as a heel?
I don't know. I mean, he's the right demographic.
Right.
Certainly.
Who would have been a better Lance Von Erich than Kevin Vaughn?
There's a question. Well, here's the thing.
Helwig?
Well, the thing that's obviously the fascinating part about it is they picked a well-known local school athlete. So it's all doomed. But did they pick him because he was a guy who looked plausibly like he could be a relative? Because he did. So was it like, we found this local guy that looks like he could be related, so that's why we picked him?
We found the local guy. He's also on the gas. We should get him to be our brother or cousin, whatever.
No, but seriously, did they pick him because he looked like a Von Erich, so to speak?
I'm not sure, because I guess is the story that they picked him to be Cousin Lance and then sent him to Portland as Ricky Vaughn, where the fans there thought he was awful. Yes. So that was where they sent him, like, you know. That was Fritz's, like, the last throes of Fritz's power within the NWA. Like, listen, kid, we're going to send you to Portland, to Don Owen.
No, but seriously, like, but they had also brought up the Cousin Lance idea, I think, even before there was a Ricky Vaughn.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Who would be, I mean, I guess the Terry Taylor, though, would fit.
Terry Taylor would fit. I mean, now I'm trying to think who from Mid-South would have fit. Before that relationship fell apart. You know, obviously the Midnight Express were good fits, but they were out quickly and they never got to do anything with the Von Erichs.
I was saying as Lance, even Terry Taylor could work.
Oh, Terry Taylor. Okay. Okay.
But I mean, in general, you know, the Midnights they thought were too small though.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's anyone else that's like British that could have come in with Adams.
I don't know.
Because, I mean, well, he was a fairly big guy for a British wrestler for that era, though. And he had already come to the States, so.
I'm such a mark for the Kevin Von Erich, Chris Adams feud.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, all of the matches, the Cotton Bowl one especially, the Sam Houston Coliseum one.
Oh, when he gets on the mic at the Cotton Bowl and starts yelling at Kevin Von Erich, it's like one of the greatest heel things ever. I love that. You know, and everyone says Kevin Von Erich, he couldn't work. He was great. I'm sorry. Up until when he completely gave up, he was believable. Yeah, he was stiff, but he was believable. Like, you didn't watch him and think, like, this is a guy who thinks he's performing tonight. You watch him and you think, like, this is a guy totally into his match.
You think?
Yeah, he's so good. Again, that Chris Adams feud with him is just so awesome.
That's definitely his peak as a performer, Kevin's. I don't think there's any arguing with that.
As an individual. He would never reach that point ever again. I'm just trying to think if there was anything before then, you know, that would fall into that category. You know what I just watched the other day for the first time in a while? The 6-man match from Texas Stadium 84, May of 84, the first Parade of Champions. And it's like one of my geeky wrestling fan moments. The ring entrances for that match are like one of my favorite things ever in Dallas wrestling. Just Bad Street USA comes on and out comes Michael Hayes, is like doing his dancing and everything. And behind him, Terry Gordy looks like the biggest badass on the planet. And he's holding that 6-man trophy. And Buddy Roberts almost looks like a badass too, even though he's like a little bouncy behind him. And then the Von Erichs come out to stranglehold. And
Fritz in his grandpa clothes.
Fritz looks like you know, it's amazing. Here's a guy, he's old and everything, and he's out of shape. He looks like a guy who can kick your ass. Like, there isn't anyone like that around wrestling today.
Like, he looks like a grandpa who's going to kick your ass. Yes.
Yeah.
But he's wearing, like, generic grandpa clothes. His Street Fight outfit is
Give me the denim. Give me the denim. Yeah, but as they come out the entrance, Kerry comes out with them. And he kind of, like, it looks like he's almost giving him, like, a pep talk. And then he turns around and runs back in to get ready for his championship match against Ric Flair. And they come out and... You know, it's one of those things you don't see anymore in wrestling, like a street fight where the guys are either dressed in street clothes or all dressed differently. Fritz is dressed in his grandpa clothes. Kevin, I guess, knowing he's going to hit a gusher, is wearing white pants and nothing else. No shoes, obviously, no shirt. Mike's wearing, like, you know, looks like, you know, just a typical kid going to a Judas Priest concert or something. And the Freebirds are all, you know, dressed like, you know, they have boots and they have jeans and... Like, that's the way it should be. I mean, I remember that great, what was it? It was like the Horsemen against Dusty and maybe TA and someone else. Like
Lawler.
No, but the one that was on TV, the one that was on, like, Worldwide.
Oh, the one
where Ric Flair comes out. Ric Flair comes out in, like, a pink polo shirt, like, for the street fight.
Oh, yes. Okay. I know the image. I can't think of the match.
Yeah. Like, you don't see that anymore. Like, everyone's ready in their wrestling gear for everything, for every run-in. I mean, they're ready with their music, too, you know, for every run.
That's been going on for a long time in the WWF, though, because think about this for a second. Think about Ric Flair in his first WWF run. Is Ric Flair ever not in his robe and gear?
Only when he had the doctored photos with Liz.
But other than that?
No.
See?
That's a good point. Yeah. You never got to see Ric Flair in a suit in WWF. I never thought of that before in his original run.
Nope.
And he wasn't the Nature Boy either.
Nope. He was the real world champion, and he was just Ric Flair.
Yeah.
Well, I totally forgot about the Nature Boy part, though.
Oh, yeah. They dropped the Nature Boy thing, and then they didn't even want to get 2001, so they gave him some generic Ric Flair music, which they later used for Buddy Landell, like, for his one-night run in 95 before his ankle injury.
Yeah. And then have you ever seen the... There's a Mid-South street fight. It's on one of the house show tapes where it's Ernie Ladd and I forget who else in what I've seen described as Ernie Ladd dressing how you'd expect a black Republican to show up at a street fight.
I'm not sure if I've seen that.
He's wearing like a polo and khakis and like a two-toned polo.
Well, I would guess timing-wise that had to be 84, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So who would he be working with? He worked with Brad Armstrong at the end of the year.
It might have been like him and someone against Master G and someone. I don't
know. You know, that was the perfect way to utilize a guy like him that year where he was totally shot. His knees were shot. But he was mixed in with all those young, fast guys like him, like Sonny King all of a sudden popped up that year.
Yep.
But it worked because they were mixed in with all this excitement. So it didn't really make you focus on how little they could do at that time. You know, if it had happened in 83, it would have been all you focused on because it was such a slower territory that year.
And he could still do stuff. I mean, his knees are gone, but he's still getting up high for those double leg drops he'd do.
Yeah, but he made the mistake that year to shave his facial hair. He never looked
as cool. Oh, that made him look really old, too.
Yeah, and he never looked as cool without the facial hair. I could listen to Ernie Ladd on a loop all day, just go, Andre the Dummy, like over and over and over again.
Oh, I can never remember what the setup line where he's like, I got a fist in your mouth or whatever it is, that whole thing. Like, and then I beat him in front of the general public.
Ernie Ladd in World Class. Does that work? No.
He did work there a little bit, though, around.
I'm talking around that time. I don't think it would. Really, you know, think about it. They're trying to get like baby faces and they bring in rock and roll Buck Zumhoff.
Well,
what the hell?
I'm sure that territory had a certain demographic appeal to him at the time.
But beyond the fact that, look, Buck Zumhoff's now in jail for being a disgusting, you know, pervert. But I'm just saying that in terms of Buck Zumhoff, if you could not look at that, just look at his place in the wrestling world, the 1983, 1984. No. They bring him in 84 as an undercard babyface. Like, why him? Like, there had to be a better pick that didn't suck, you know, like Buck Zumhoff did. They tried Billy Jack. They brought in Billy Jack Haynes. And then, of course, that's another one of the places he walked out on with, like, no notice.
Billy Jack Haynes things happened.
Yeah, that happened quite often.
I've tried – just who else I mean, just, there are so many people that you know what the answer is? It's just so many guys were homesteading the territory that there weren't that many spots.
Yeah. You weren't going to be able to be a top babyface past the Von Erichs.
And the heel spots, I mean, that turned over a little bit, but not really.
The Freebirds lasted on and off for 2 years, and then it was Chris and Gino for a whole year.
Yeah.
And then the territory fell apart when Gino died, and they left the NWA, and Gino died, and Chris Adams went blind, as Bill Mercer announced on TV, and they named Rick Rude as their heavyweight champion, and they lost all their talent to Mid-South, and then Mid-South ran all the same angles that they did in World Class, and then they went into Dallas against them, and that's like the end right there, for me at least.
Yeah, I like the 88-89. I like the Jarrett era world. Well, no, there's two parts. There's the brief Michael Hayes booking run, which I really like, and then the Jarrett, and then when Jarrett takes over, I like the last few years of
well, 88. There's good stuff, but I'm superficial. I like the production and the full sportatorium.
Yeah, there are some times where they figure out how to shoot better though in 88.
Okay, well, it never looks as bright and fresh as it did. Up until, you know, the end of 85.
No, and then you've got your 80s. The worst shows ever from the Sportatorium, at least pre-global, are the 87 World Class shows.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And the 91 USWA shows.
Yeah.
Where there's just no. When you can see, like, rows of benches at the Sportatorium.
Yeah, and on global, when they would show, when some violence would happen.
Where's Waldo guy?
Well, the guy I always remember is like the trucker guy with the beard and the mustache and the trucker hat, and he was just like falling asleep. They showed him over and over again.
See, I remember the dancing guy dressed like Where's Waldo?
You know, I saw today that WWE on their network is going to do a global cruiserweight show, and I was like, oh my God, they're going to finally re-air all the stuff with the Lightning Kid and Jerry Lynn? And then I was like, oh no, it's something else. I got excited for a minute there. But anyway, Roddy Piper in Dallas.
Theoretically.
Theoretically. I did want to say one more thing. I forgot it earlier when we were doing the follow-up on Coco, but a few people got in touch with us, and I think even Bo James said it, that the rumor was that Coco was beating up the guy because he was an outlaw. He had worked shows against the Jarrett company, specifically worked for Poffo. I just want to say I don't believe that. Because
of the timeline. Yeah.
The timeline doesn't make any sense. Poffo folded up end of 83, and their TV show was just using Memphis footage mixed in with their own previously recorded footage, and Savage and Lanny were working full time for Memphis. Well, Savage first from December of 83 on, and then Lanny came after his Mid-South run shortly thereafter. So I don't think they were running anything. So I don't think the bootleg Patriot had been working there. So, but again, we're still on the case and we will try to get some answers.
Maybe. It's something like, if it is – the only explanation I can think of if it's Poffo with the timeline is that it's a guy who they had not found – that, like, he was actually working for both somehow, like doing jobs on Jarrett TV under a mask and also working for Poffo, and just they didn't find out till then. Something ridiculous. Like, it doesn't make sense. But
that's really ridiculous. That's almost 2 years later.
So it's probably just working for some little tiny outlaw show.
Yeah. So
don't you love I love how proprietary they were in that area, even for all these people who were drawing nobody and not even trying to threaten them. Like, you know, Savage and Family, at least they're like, you know, they're calling them out and whatever. Here it's like, you know, like JB Dundee and Wolfie got heat for working tiny indie shows when they couldn't get booked on the USWA stuff. Like, okay. I never understood, like, why there would be so much heat, like, even, you know, once the territory era is really over.
You know what? Was Nick Gulas running 85, 86? Because isn't that where Mark Aline and Terry Sims started?
He was running in some form through, like, 88, on and off.
So maybe that's it. Maybe he worked for Gulas.
Hmm. Well.
Well, as we'll hear later on in a little bit, Jerry Jarrett was certainly jealous, didn't want to do business with anyone that did business with Nick Gulas. We'll hear in a part two of the Scott Teal interview shortly. But first, it is time for our Book of the Week, Bix.
Yes, and of course for this and anything else we talk about on here, make sure to use our Amazon referral URL. We have a link in the show notes, as always. But if you want to jot it down right now or whatever, it is a tinyurl.com/605Amazon. And this week's book of the week, we were trying to figure out what to pick, and I realized we have something that ties into Scott Teal Part 2, because it is a Scott Teal book, but it also kind of ties into something current, and that is J.J. Gillen's book, which is titled Wrestlers Are Like Seagulls. You can get that on Kindle from Amazon, which is, and like I said, it is from Crowbar Press, and one of the very best wrestling books. Would you agree?
Yeah, I really, really like that book. JJ had a really good memory. I guess a lot of it would have been based off notes because he had booking sheets for all those years where he's working under Dusty. But I love that book. I think it's a great book.
Yeah, and the reason I picked that one, because we were thinking, should it be one of the Crowbar Press books or whatever, I was thinking that there's been a lot of talk about Vince McMahon this last week or so because of the whole Titus O'Neil suspension. I mean, briefly, for those of you who are listening and not really following current wrestling, Titus O'Neil is a current WWE talent who touched, grabbed, jostled something Vince when everyone was leaving after the Daniel Bryan thing last week, and Vince turned around and shoved him. Apparently, Titus grabbed him, whatever. And this has led to all sorts of talk about the way Vince conducts himself, you know, Vince's encouraging horseplay, whatever. And I think there's no better wrestling book for firsthand accounts of Vince McMahon than J.J. Dillon's Wrestlers Are Like Seagulls. Would you agree?
I think so. Unfortunately, due to confidentiality, I don't think he can get into as much as he'd like to. There's certain things, especially around the steroid tests.
I mean, he says outright specifically in the book he cannot say anything about the steroid testing because of whatever he had signed. Yes, but
yeah. So, but otherwise, it's a great book. Definitely one worth checking out. You can get a physical copy at crowbarpress.com. But again, if you use our tinyurl.com/605Amazon link, and that, and anything else you put in your shopping cart after you use that link, we will get a little kickback for. So, I know Steve Austin asks you to do that, and Jericho and Jim Ross. But here's the thing: they're millionaires. And it's just me and Bix. So, you know, take your pick. Who do you want to give your money to? The 1% or the skim? It's up to you.
And, of course, there are tons of other great things in that book. Lots of talk about different territories. Amarillo, how he became a manager.
I like the story he tells about how, you know, he leaves Crockett to go – well, I guess it was already Turner at that time. He leaves Turner early 89 to go work for Vince, and – when Dusty's finishing up his run, Dusty wanted to have a meeting with Vince, and Dusty was just so upset JJ was in the room because JJ used to be his assistant. He's like, you know, can he leave the room? Can I have a minute alone with you? And JJ left, and he came back. He's like, you know, Vince, he's like to Vince, what did he tell you? He's like, he told me that there's two geniuses in the wrestling business, me and him.
And just what else? There's, you know, a lot of just interesting insight to the various jobs he did over the, like, again, another thing, when he leaves for the WWF, he was the one timing out all the pay-per-views and clashes and, you know, whatever live shows. And apparently nobody knew that he did that, and nobody was set up to replace him, which is why multiple, like, two shows in a row had weird timing issues. Like, a Chi-Town Rumble had the whole thing where they ran a prelim match after the main event that didn't air on every pay-per-view system, which was, what was it, Kendall Windham and Steve Casey?
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. Right. What the? Yeah. Oh, can you imagine? What was it, like 20 minutes they worked?
Well, right. And then it didn't air most places. But then it kept going because no one was giving them a go home signal either.
Yeah.
And then there was the whole thing with the Clash of the Champions in New Orleans, where you watch it and you think it's supposed to be by design that that some of the matches don't air with Sting, not Sting, with Flair and Steamboat going long. But no, that was just a nobody remembering to replace JJ at timing the show. So, but, you know, different target, you know, talking about even how he was a referee years before he actually started wrestling. You know, good stories about Bruno. There's just so much. It's not a super long book. It's a good length book, but it's not a have a nice day Bret Hart length book, but he packs a lot in there.
Yeah, it's an exceptional book. Look, I'm a big fan of all the stuff Scott Teal has put out. And usually when I name books, that's one of the first ones off the top of my head. Usually it's, you know, The Assassin, JJ, Ole Anderson, Stan Hansen, JJ's book is great. So again, check it out, tinyurl.com/605Amazon. And we've mentioned Scott Teal, and now I guess it's time for part two of our conversation with Scott. We're glad so many people like part one. I put up a few of his old Slammogram programs online on my Twitter page and also on our Facebook page, facebook.com/superpodcast. So you can check that out. I'll put up a couple more after this one airs. But he'll talk more about that in here. And Bix, you know, this is it's interesting. You know, part one is really kind of like his background, a little bit about the book company. Here in part two, the listeners will hear him talk a little bit more about what was going on with Ghoulis and some of the big milestones that happened, from Jarrett breaking off from Ghoulis to Ghoulis selling out, and how Scott fit into that, but also upcoming books he's working on.
Yeah, he's got a lot of interesting stuff coming down the pipe. Dick the Bruiser, I mean, that I'm looking forward to a lot.
Oh yeah, I talked to Cornette about it, and he like shit his pants when I said there's a definitive Dick the Bruiser biography coming out. So, but we'll talk more about this at the end of the interview. But without further ado, here is part two of our conversation with Scott Teal of Crowbar Press. I'm very fortunate in that I actually have a lot of original copies of the old Slammograms that you did.
Oh, and awesome.
And I want to ask you about some of the guys that you covered in there and just get your thoughts on them, because so many of them are guys that, you know, unfortunately, these Slammograms that you did and your recounting of the storylines and the angles that took place are in many cases the only evidence that exists that any of this stuff happened, just because obviously there's no videotapes, or at least nothing that's been uncovered of so much of this stuff. One of the guys who's in a lot of the issues I have here, who is someone who many aspects of his life had taken on a bit of an urban legend, is what about the bicentennial baby, Big Bad John?
I love John. He was the sweetest guy. He was loud and bombastic, but man, what an interview he was. He wasn't very good as far as being a wrestler, but man, he could interview. He could talk his way into anything. I mean, what a good guy. I love John. I first met John in Florida around 1973. It wasn't anything where we became friends. It's just, hi, how are you doing? I'm Scott. And that was it. But then when he came up there, it's just like he remembered me from being down there taking pictures. But he didn't, you know, it was just like we were all old friends. And he was a good guy, a real, real good guy.
You mentioned that, unlike many of the wrestlers who have bad things to say about Nick Ghoulis, that you know, on a personal level, can't say anything bad about him. I'm curious what your relationship with George Ghoulis was, because here's someone who it's very hard to hear anyone say anything good about. So what did you feel? What were your thoughts on George Ghoulis?
Well, again, there I go. I owe George everything. He was just like his dad to me. He treated me well. He'd call me all the time, say, "What?" In fact, he's the one that got me set up doing the programs in Huntsville. You know, he came to me. He says, "You know, we don't have a program in Huntsville. Why don't you think about doing it?" And he never, you know, and my whole thought the whole time, you know, what are they going to want for? What's George going to want for it? Because he did everything he could to help me get set up with that, and he never asked for one dime. But he'd call and say, "We're doing this. We're doing that. Why don't you try this?" I mean, there were so many things he helped me with, and I have, just like Nick, I have nothing but good to say about him. And I will say this about George. George was brought up in the world of wrestling. I don't think there's anybody, I don't care who it is, that was brought up that wouldn't want to be a part of it. George loved the business. He wanted so badly to be a wrestler, but he probably just didn't have what it, you know, he didn't have what it took, you know, and I can't knock him for that, because it's Nick's fault more than anything, because Nick pushed him farther than he should have gone. Yeah. But I will say one thing about George's character. People can say what they want, but somebody got on an interview several years ago, and I mean ripped him up one side down the other, called him one of the worst wrestlers in the world. Somebody else said he was one of the worst three wrestlers in the world. George did an interview with the same interviewer the within that week, and he had heard the interview. I think it was Frank Morrell. He had heard the interview Frank did. He didn't say one bad thing. He says, "Well, I'll tell you what." He said, "That's Frank's opinion. I'm not going to say anything bad about Frank. He was a good wrestler." In fact, if you can find the interview, I encourage you to listen to it.
It was Gary Kubeta's website, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And it was very good what he said. He said nothing bad about anyone. And he, you know, Gary even challenged it, not mean-wise, but he challenged him on it. He says, you know, well, they say you're the three worst wrestlers. And George says, well, that may be. He says, at least I'm not. He says, I hope I'm not the worst wrestler. He says, but he says, that may be. He says, I just did what I had to do and tried my best. And he didn't knock anybody because of what anybody said. And yet I have people that's been to our reunion here at our house that, past is the past. You know, I'm not going to say anything bad about George. And then next thing, they're writing a book and saying bad things about George and making all this stuff, you know. And I'm thinking, give me a break, you know. But you read Jerry Lawler's book. He had good things to say about Nick. I'm back to Nick now. You know, Bill Dundee has good things to say about Nick. You know, Nick did some things that people didn't like. And I know the stories. I've heard the stories.
Well, but, you were working for Nick when the famed 77 breakup between Gulas Welch and Jerry Jarrett took place. You know, what were you thinking when all this was going on?
I didn't go to Memphis. I take it back. I went to Memphis occasionally, maybe once a month. But there's my phone trying to ring in. Message. I went to Memphis, maybe once a month. I didn't have the program there. So there was no reason for me to go other than just to go. You know, I'd ride, once a month I'd ride with somebody there and take pictures. But, you know, it wasn't somewhere I went to make any money, so I didn't go every week. I could have gone to Birmingham, I guess, and done the same thing. But when the split happened, it really, you know, I didn't, I, you know, I, of course, you know, there's a lot of buzz. Everybody's talking this and that. And, I don't know that I paid a whole lot of attention to it except what I heard from the guys. Frankie Lane was working, went with Jerry. And I was real, real good friends with Frankie Lane. So he'd come back and tell me what was going on. I was working for Nick all that time. And I hope this doesn't sound bad on my part. But right after they split, Jerry Lawler called and wanted to know if I'd write stories for their program. And I said, Jerry, I said, I'd love to do it. I said, but if Nick found out, I said, I'd be in big trouble. He says, well, he says, all you have to do is just bring him by the house. We didn't have email then. Yeah. Because I lived not too far from him in Hendersonville. And so every week I'd bring him five stories for the program and he'd hand me $50.
Wow.
Next week, same thing. I did that for about, I'd say 10 weeks, I guess. And then one week Jerry calls me, or I went to his house and he gave me the $50 and he says, I hate to tell you this. He says, but, we won't be needing your stories anymore. He says, I really like the way you write. He says, but Jerry Jarrett found out I was paying you $50 for the stories. And he thought that was a waste of money. I said, that's fine. I understand. It's business is business. You know, he feels it's a waste of money. That's okay. I'm no problem with that. So that was the end of that. But, that's about all, as close as I came to really paying a whole lot of attention to what they were doing. Of course, like I said, at that point, I had to know what they were doing because, I had to know what kind of angles to push in the program. But that, it was sort of nice to be able to do that for a short while for the Memphis program.
Yeah.
I'll tell you another story. One other time, I got myself in a little hot water with another promotion is when the Luthez's UWA came into town. Of course, they're opposition to Nick and. And a lot of my friends were working for them, Ramey and the interns and Saul Weingroff, Frank Morrell, a lot of the guys, I knew real well. And Al Costello called me one day. This was just before they came into Tennessee. They were going to have a big card up in Springfield, Tennessee, just north of Nashville. And Al says, Scott, he says, would you come up and shoot some pictures for us? He says, we need publicity pictures. And if you could just come up and take a bunch of pictures, we'll pay you for them. And he says, but we need some. And I said, sure. So I went up to Springfield that night, took pictures and went back home and, developed them and sold, you know, sent them took them to Al, and he paid me for them. So that Wednesday night, it may have been the next night, that Wednesday night I go to the fairgrounds, and I walk in, somebody says, Nick wants to see you. I said, okay. And it really didn't dawn on me what he might want to see me for. I don't know why I didn't think of it. He pulled me into the dressing room. He pulled me aside. He says, Scott, he says, somebody tells me you were at the UWA card in Springfield last night. I said, yeah, I just went down there. I said, Al Costello asked me to go shoot some pictures for him. And now, knowing, if you knew Nick, you probably would have thought, you know, he would have chewed me out, because he had chewed people. I mean, he did. He chewed people out over nothing, you know. He looked at me. He says, well, he says, I just wish you wouldn't do that. He says, because it looks bad. And it dawned on me at that point. Yes, it did. You know, I didn't think anything about it being opposition. I was just shooting pictures for my friends.
Yeah.
But it dawned on me, yes, it did look bad. Here I was. I worked for Nick, and I was going to the opposition show. It didn't look good at all. And I said, Nick, I said, I am so sorry. I said, it just didn't even dawn on me. And I told him what I just said. You know, I just went to take pictures, because a lot of them are my friends. And I said, it won't happen again. You'll never see me at one of their cards. And he says, well, I appreciate that, Scott. And, you know, he could have fired me right there. You know, he could have chewed me out. I mean, like I said, I've heard him chew guys out. Oh, my goodness. He doesn't mince words. But there's just another example of how good he treated me. And it may be the reason I sort of think he did. Is a lot of wrestlers, when they come in here, if they really need it, especially the, you know, the underneath guys, they need a place to work. Nick probably didn't treat them nice or as well, because he knew they needed them. Me, he knew I was in college and I didn't intend to make it a full-time career. Although if he had stayed in business, I probably would have. But he knew that I didn't need him, and you know that, if you know that, I might just up and leave. And so I think there's a difference. You know what I'm talking about? Sometimes.
Yeah.
You know.
Did you have much interaction with Roy Welch?
Not a bit. I don't know. I don't think I ever met Roy. I think he was out of the business before I started working for Nick.
Okay. And, you know, what was it like at the end? Because you were with Nick until he sold to Jarrett in 80 or 81. I forget exactly when it would have been. So what was it like there at the end? And was it just once he sold, you were done? Was there any talk between you and the Jarrett office, or was that it?
You know, I still don't understand fully what the deal was. I got a call from Dick Steinborn one day, and he said, Scott, Buddy Fuller has bought Nick's promotion. He's going to be the promoter now, starting next Wednesday night out the Fairgrounds Arena. He says, we'd like you to continue to do the program, but I'd like to come over and talk to you about it. And so he wanted me to change the name from Slammogram to Mid-America Mat News, which I did. It was no big deal. And we doubled the size. I think we doubled the size of the program. He wanted me. What I was doing is I'd sell the program, like I said, in Chattanooga, Huntsville, Birmingham. I mean, Bowling Green, Nashville. And it was a generic program, and I put an insert in there with a card. They wanted the card printed on the inside, which cost, at that time, that cost a whole lot more, because, you know, the more you get of one type at that time, the cheaper price you got. But if you had to change up and have a different card in every program, that costs, you know, a lot more money. But we did that about 2 or 3 weeks, and Dick came and he says, man, he says, programs aren't selling like I thought they were. He says, just go back doing it the way you were. And I worked for Buddy for about, I'm wanting to say about 8 weeks. And one day I get a phone call once again from my good friend Jerry Jarrett. He says, Scott, Buddy's not going to be promoting anymore. He says, we're taking over the promotion and we're bringing in my guy, so we won't need your program anymore. I said, well, I understand that. I said, I just had programs printed for tomorrow night's card. And I said, though, I said, can I go ahead and sell those? He says, no. He says, we've got our own program. I said, okay, oh, that's fine. Man. Yeah, here I was. I mean, I was making decent money, but it was, I was still a college student, you know, struggling, and it sort of ticked me off, you know. Because I just spent $300 on those things, on the program for the week, and so anyway, that was it. And that's when I said, I'm through with wrestling. You know, I probably won't have anything. I won't have anything to do with it again. It's really nothing for me. I didn't want to go anywhere else, or I just didn't think there was anything else I could do in wrestling, you know, other than programs. And we were sort of homesteaded there in Nashville. I had a good job with UPS, so I said, that's it. I'll just hang it up, and wrestling's behind me. Well, little did I know. 15, 16 years later, now look at me.
Did you have any involvement with the Georgia office when they were running Chattanooga?
No, but I went quite a few times to – not quite a few. I went several times to Atlanta, shot pictures for the magazines, and I knew real well, I take that back. I didn't know her at the time. When I came up to Nashville to go to Trevecca Nazarene College, I was in the concert choir, and we were going to go to Atlanta on leave on Saturday, and then sing at a church in Atlanta on Sunday. And it was going to be at the Nazarene Church there, which Trevecca is a Nazarene college. I had never met Danny and Vicky Goddard. Are you familiar with those names?
I don't think so.
Yeah, Danny and Vicky. Danny was the president in the late 60s of the Sputnik Monroe fan club, or the Monroe Brothers fan club. He was very, very close to Sputnik and Rocket Monroe, and to an extent, Flash. They were almost like uncles or fathers to them, to Danny and Vicky. They loved those kids. They loved those two. The Monroes loved them. So anyway, they were involved in the WFIA, the Wrestling Fans International Association. And so one day I thought, I'm going to call Vicky. I've never talked to her, never met her. I only knew of her through the magazines and things like that. I'd seen pictures of her and her brother in the magazines. I thought, I'm going to call her and tell her that we're going to be in Atlanta singing at a church. So I call her, and come to find out, it's her church. Now, go figure that. It was their church, and she said, we talked for a while, and she could not believe I was coming down there to sing, especially in the wrestling business. It's Vicky and I used to call it the mission field. it's sort of a rough place, you know. It's not exactly a real Christian atmosphere. but anyway, she said she got off the phone. She told me later she got off the phone, and she told Danny, her brother, she says, Danny, guess what? Scott Teal's going to be at our church singing with the Trevecca Nazarene Concert Choir. And he says, yeah, right. I mean, he just didn't believe it. But that's how I met them. And so that's really the only inroads I had with the Georgia office. Bobby Simmons, I guess, knew of me through Vicky. And I had talked to Bobby once or twice, I guess, when I went down for shows. And I met a lot of guys. I met Lanny Poffo for the first time when I was down in Athens, Georgia. Bill Bowman, a lot of those guys I met for the first time down there. So I didn't have any direct involvement. I wish I had, but I did, you know, like I said, I did make it up there a few times.
Now, I know you said that you said you never really understood exactly how the transition to when Jarrett completely took over Nashville took place. One thing, like, I've never been clear on, and then because I know there was also a lawsuit and stuff, what exactly happened to where Gulas kind of came back into the mainstream fold, work sort of working with Jarrett before all that? Like, I don't know exactly how long it was, but around 1980, like when the Blonde Bombers would go in and out of Memphis to Gulas and then back.
Yeah, well, that actually, if I remember correctly, that was after Nick sold out. That was Buddy Fuller.
Oh, okay.
I'm not confused about how Jarrett got the promotion. I'm just not certain how the business dealings happened.
Right.
In other words, what was Buddy? I never heard a word about Jerry Jarrett having any part of that promotion when Buddy Fuller first came over. From what I understood, Buddy Fuller bought the promotion from Nick and ran it for about as long, till 7 or 8 weeks, and I got the phone call from Jerry Jarrett. At that point, that's the first time I ever heard anything or knew anything about Jerry Jarrett owning the Nashville territory. So I always assumed Buddy bought the territory, and then 8 weeks later, Jarrett bought the territory. But looking back, I sort of wonder if maybe Jarrett had been the money man all along, because Nick would have sold to Buddy, but he wasn't going to sell to Jerry because, the heat there. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know, the full story. And even in Jerry's book, I don't think Jerry really – I don't know. I'm going to have to look at that again in his book. Give me about 10 minutes. No, I'm kidding.
No, but wasn't Buddy Jerry's partner when he broke off from Nick and Roy?
I think Buddy had had a part of, of the promotion as well. But so I don't know. Like I said, I just don't know what the deal was, how Nick sold the territory, who he actually sold it to, or what the contract was, or any of that, or if there was a contract. I don't know. I don't really know.
And do you know anything about then the lawsuit that Jarrett and Edward Welch filed against Gulas in 1980? Because I found that clipping a while back, and it surprised me because, I don't really understand how exactly Gulas and Jarrett fit into each other. But, here they are saying that – let me read – because I have it right in front of me. The headline was sabotage alleged by wrestling suit. And I could even read it here, but it was – let me see quickly what it says. They're seeking damages of $850,000, allegedly because of a dispute with Jarrett and Welch as to how Gulas would be paid for the remaining 25% of his stock. Gulas began in August 1980 to systematically, knowingly, and maliciously take actions intended to be of substantial damage to the plaintiffs, Jarrett and Welch, to jeopardize the plaintiffs. This is the stuff from the lawsuit itself. And then among the actions taken by Gulas alleged in the suit include the following. On August 26, 1980, Gulas took the corporate checkbook and other records from the corporate offices and closed their corporate checking account, urged all employees of the company to quit, encouraged some wrestlers that had been promoted by Gulas Wrestling Enterprises to find other promoters. September 7, 1980, caused WTVF-TV to break a contract to televise wrestling matches promoted by the company and encouraged the station to break a subsequent contract, thwarted the purchase by Ronald Welch, which is Ronald Welch, Buddy Fuller?
Ronald Welch is Ron Fuller.
Oh, it's Ron Fuller. Right. Why am I thinking?
Yes.
Why did I get that wrong? I'm in my head. I'm like, wait, what? Why did I? Anyway, he thwarted the purchase of Ronald Welch to the portion of the company that operated out of Birmingham by threatening to have Birmingham television station cancel the televised wrestling programs. Then they quote the suit saying the net revenues from the Nashville operation, which are derived from wrestling fans attending wrestling matches in Nashville, dropped substantially, resulting in substantial economic loss to the plaintiffs, all of which was caused by the above-referenced actions of Gulas. Gulas, who sold his portion of the promotion firm he began for $106,703, cannot be reached for comment last night. Yeah, do you know about any of this?
I remember that. I just pulled up some notes here I have. Jerry and I guess it was Ron, Buddy Fuller, Edward Welch. They were charging that Nick, like you said, Nick had taken the records and closed the checking account. He had gone apparently behind their back and urged some of the wrestlers to quit working for them. They said he was spreading rumors that they were about to go broke or couldn't pay their debts. So they were suing him for that. Well, it wasn't long after that Nick filed a $2.2 million countersuit against them. He said he sold 75% of the company to them for $43,000 in cash, and they were supposed to pay him $500 a week towards the remaining balance of, I think it's $90,000. And that of course, he says they were trying to wreck the company by several things, using workers who were untrained. Uh, going behind their back, trying to screw up their televisions and different different things like that. You know, he was asking $2.2 million and 25% until the, you know, the legal charges were concluded. I don't know whatever came of it, but that's all I know. I know that they sued him and then he sued them, and who knows? I don't know if he ever got, you know, the rest of his money or not. I couldn't tell you. I will say this. The territory, Nick's territory, really was on the downslide. I mean, I could see it even through my program sales. I could tell it. You know, the crowds got less and less and less towards the end before he sold to Buddy. And I don't know that – I think if Buddy and Jerry had waited a little longer, Nick may have just almost given it to him, you know, or just pulled out, just quit promoting, because it was getting pretty bad there towards the end. I mean, he was still, you know, drawn, okay, but it wasn't nothing like it, you know, had been in its heyday. And it was nothing like it was in 1974 when I first got there. You know, by 1980, I'd say the houses were probably half of what they had been. Chattanooga was probably, like I said, the best town he had at that point. But I don't know. I wish I knew more about it.
You had mentioned how, you know, Boyd Pierce, anything he sent you at Wrestling King of Sport would sell. I'm curious as to which wrestler in the Nicholas territory, if you put him on the program or if you had pictures for sale, who
Jackie Fargo. You don't even ask me that.
It was that simple. Wow.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Jackie Fargo is – I don't care. When that's what Nick always went back to Jackie. Of course, Jackie and Tojo, they both stuck by Nick when Jarrett went out, you know, and took –
That's right.
Took everybody with him. Jackie and Tojo stuck with Nick. And they, Jackie, whenever Nick needed a shot in the arm, he'd do some kind of angle with Jackie. Jackie wasn't wrestling all the time, you know, every week. He'd wrestle for a while. Then he had other businesses. He had his bookie business. He did numbers and all kinds of gambling stuff. And then when Nick needed a shot in the arm, he'd call Jackie, and Jackie'd come in. They'd do some kind of angle, like they did with Hickerson and Condry. They supposedly, you know, caught him on the side of the road and blacked his eye and beat him up real bad. And, man, they packed the Chattanooga Auditorium that week. My goodness, it was unbelievable. And then they bring in Roughhouse Fargo. Jackie, you know, when he gets mad enough, I'm calling in my brother Nuthouse. And they bring in Sonny Fargo from North Carolina. And, man, you talk about full houses. Those places would pack. They'd pack people out in all the arenas. So, yeah, Jackie was the name. He was the man in Tennessee. And until Jerry Lawler, you know, hit his stride, Jackie couldn't be beat. But Lawler, I have to give him a lot of credit. He knew the wrestling business. I mean, he knew, I don't know, he just knew what to do. And he was the big, a lot of people would still say Jackie Fargo was the biggest name in pro wrestling in Memphis. But I'd have to say if it's got probably a tie, I'd say, between Jackie and Jerry Lawler, because Jerry Lawler was on top for years and years and years.
In both program sales and what you remember being at the arenas, what do you remember? You know, you mentioned Fargo with Hickerson and Condry, but what do you remember as being some of the hottest feuds?
Oh, man. That's the one that sticks out. I couldn't even, you know, it's like when I go to the Gulf Coast reunion down in Mobile, I hear thousands of stories, and I come home, I don't remember one of them because I hear so much it almost like burns everything up. And I think that's really, as far as feuds go, that's a hard thing for me to even think right now to come up with. I know Frankie Lane had some great – we had some great houses with Frankie Lane and Roger Kirby. Had great houses with Roger Kirby and Gorgeous George Jr. I just have to stop and think. You know, I couldn't name them off the top of my head right now.
All right. Well, circling back to Crowbar Press, there is something I wanted to ask you about that was in one of your books that I found fascinating, and it's something Bix and I had discussed that really hasn't been out there a lot. A book that you did that I actually really enjoy, I think it's underrated, and I say that only because I don't hear too many people talk about it, is Too Much Too Soon, the Tony Atlas story. And yeah. In that book, Tony talks about his ex-wife, Lisa. I don't know if that's her real name or if he used, you know, an alias, but he mentions that Lisa had been an ex-girlfriend of Jimmy Snuka and had been in the hotel room the night that Jimmy Snuka had the infamous, the alleged murder at this point with his girlfriend at the time. And, you know, it's one of those stories that never, other than it being in that book that you published, I've never seen it out there. I haven't seen anyone follow up on it. I haven't seen anyone ask Tony Atlas about it. Do you have any memories of when he, you know, I don't know how you, the process you had with him to do the book, if it's something where he told it to you or if he wrote it and delivered it to you, but what did you think when you first, what did you think when you first heard that?
I'm sorry, I had to laugh. Tony and Don Fargo are probably the only two wrestlers who wrote a book who can't read or write. that's the truth, and they'll admit it. I mean, Tony, I tease him about it all the time. But yeah, no, he doesn't read or write, so he wouldn't have written anything down. Everything Tony's book was done in the way where I called him, and we'd talk every now and then, and I have an 18-page questionnaire that I anything. There's nothing hardly you can think of about pro wrestling that isn't on that sheet. And I go through that questionnaire when I do some of these books, and that's how I did with Tony. I call him and I just ask him question after question and just record and record and record. And then when I'm through, I type it all up and then put it in some semblance of a book. And as far as Lisa goes, that's pretty much all he told me. Now that you mention that, I probably should have thought about asking him if she had said anything else about it. One thing, I didn't want her coming around or Jimmy, either one, and suing us. So I did sort of soft pedal, right. You know, what he said. I didn't necessarily leave anything out, but I didn't want to get into too much detail because I didn't want, you know, I didn't want to come out and say, have Tony in the book saying, yeah, Lisa told me Jimmy killed her or whatever, you know, because that opens me up to libel too.
Yeah.
What I found fascinating about it, though, is, you know, the book was, you know, a few years ago now. I don't know when exactly the process of writing it was and when you would have done the interviews, but it was before every, you know, the case getting reopened and all that. And the thing that stuck out to me when Brian and I were talking about it was that the way he describes it, which is, you know, Snuka shoving Nancy Argentino and her hitting her head on like a dresser or something in the hotel room, that matches with the autopsy, you know, that it was that she hit her head, you know, she fell and hit her head as she was going down. And that's not something, though, that was really known until, you know, about a year and a half ago or whenever it was that local newspaper article came out and they dug up the autopsy report and the police interview and stuff. So I'm like, it doesn't sound like it makes sense because if there was someone else, you know what I mean, that whole thing. But that little bit, I mean, that adds some credibility to it because otherwise, you know, it's a wrestler spinning a yarn, you would think, but that, it's like, maybe?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I that does surprise me too. The only thing I'd say is wrestling books aren't real mainstream, and so I don't know that anybody in charge of the investigation would have ever realized, you know, that Tony wrote about this in the book, because if they had picked up the book and read it, yeah, they may have tried to track down Lisa. So I don't know, maybe that it's just not out there enough that people even realize, you know, that something was said about that incident in the book.
Something else I wanted to ask you about as far as the books in general is, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, how you want to try to preserve these older books, whether it's Drawing Heat or whatever, the Gorgeous George or Luthez's book, Hooker. What's on your list of stuff that you'd either like to do or have tried to see and track down the author and stuff to do? Because, like, for example, I have right in front of me, I have a copy of Paul Bosch's book that I was lucky enough to pick up, one that was, you know, very limited run that they did at a local print shop. And, you know, of course,
yeah, I'm still trying to get that one.
Yeah, and, of course, you know, there's Gary Hart's book, of course, which I guess from a business point of view, since you know that the band is there, that if you could get that to be able to do that would be great. And there's stuff like even even more recent stuff like Butcher Vachon's books, which I don't think he sells anymore, that he did some small prints of. Like, what's on your list that you'd like to do? Is there anything that you can talk about that may be close? Like, what in that realm is there?
Let me throw one more out there while we're talking about this. But Jim Cornette, when I was on his podcast, mentioned that Smokey Galento had a Mario Galento biography that she was selling years ago. And he had purchased a copy, and I think he gave it to Mark James and hasn't seen it since. So there's another one.
It's not really an autobiography. I talked with Mark about that because I thought it might be something Mark and I could work on together. And we may still my thoughts was redoing that. And using my interview with Smokey in there, and then a transcription of that radio broadcast that Mario did, you know, all that in the book. But when Mark sent me a copy of it, of Mario's book, it's not really a biography. It's more of a fiction book, stuff he's written.
Okay.
I think, if I remember right, that's what it was. It just didn't seem like anything that interesting. You know, I do need to revisit that and see. But as far as things on the drawing board, I've got two books pretty well finished, the Dick the Bruiser book and then a book by Michael Mahalati. He's a guy from Finland, a guy you really ought to talk to. He's got a great story. He's a more modern guy. He wrestled in Japan in recent years quite a bit. His book, I'd say it'll be out in about a month or so. He's not an old school guy, but he thinks like an old school guy, and he's got a wonderful story, and it's sort of like a history of wrestling, how wrestling got started in Finland, of which he was a pioneer. And it's a pretty fascinating book. And then I've got a book I'm working on with Tom Hankins. This guy, Tom, had a great, you know, he worked a lot of independent type shows. But he was big into rock and roll and wrestling both. And man, he has got the road tales. It's going to be great when we get it. J. Michael Kenyon and I just finished a book called, Mayhem in the Garden, The Battle for New York, Shoots, Works, and Double Crosses. And it's the complete, awesome, a history of New York wrestling in New York City, all the infighting among the promoters, who was promoting, and it has every match ever held in Madison Square Garden from 1880 to present. It's got a lot of things fixed from that original little magazine with all the Madison Square Garden results I put out. But it's a history of wrestling in New York, and it's fascinating because, man, you wouldn't believe the stuff going on behind the scenes between, you know, Tex Ricard and, you know, the promoters at that time. I'm drawing a blank here. But anyway, it's that's Michael, J. Michael Kenny, and I have that. And then I've got on the works, I got 80 hours of audio with Dick Steinborn I have to get typed up. That guy has a memory like a steel trap. I asked him, I said, tell me about your match with Skull Murphy in Madison Square Garden. And he tells me the finish. He tells me what they did. It's amazing the stuff he remembers. And I've just got to find time to finish typing it up and get that going. Chavo Guerrero sent me his book. It's done really well. I have to do very little editing in it. He tells a lot about his father, Gory Guerrero, how the Guerreros got into the wrestling business. And then I'm got to call Marty Funk about Dory Funk's book. They're ready to get going with that.
Oh, man. Awesome.
Of course, my wrestling archive project, I don't know if you have heard this, but, you know, I did two interviews in the first book, Buddy Colt and Adrian Street, that had never been published. The other 14 interviews were stuff from my Whatever Happened To.
Right.
Well, if I publish nothing but my old interviews, I don't do any new interviews, but just my old interviews in those wrestling archive projects, I have enough for four or maybe five more 400-page books.
Wow.
But I plan to do new interviews. You know, I'm going to have a couple new interviews and then, you know, a bunch of the old ones in each volume as well. So, and then other guys have called. I've just got to, you know, find time. I just retired from EPS after 37 years, at the end of the end of 2015. So I'm full time writing about wrestling now. So I'll be able to get caught up on all this stuff. And, I got a lot of guys that Jimmy Golden, you know, I've talked to him about a book. I want to call Ron Fuller, do a book with them. I just got to get busy.
And is there anything that you'd like, kind of like I was saying, like as far as books like that weren't, you know, older books that you'd love to see if you could get your hands on to reprint, or like whether it's Paul Bosch's book or anything like that?
Nothing really. I contacted Phil Varialli about the Gary Hart book, but some reason he doesn't want to re-release it, and I don't understand why. As far as other books, I can't think of anything. You know, I've toyed with the idea of that From Milo to Londo's book, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't know where to go to get permission to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I can think of. You know, Chokehold, I loved the book Chokehold. Jim Wilson is Jim Wilson, but there was great information in that book. But I think that's still available, I believe. Nothing, you know, jumps right at me just thinking about it that I'd like to reprint. As far as old, there's not a whole lot of good wrestling books out there printed before, you know, that were published before 1980 or 1970. There just wasn't, you know, it's all kayfabe stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Scott,
I wish somebody had gotten with somebody like Harley Race and really picked his brain, because his book,
it's a shame
for his career. I mean, it's a shame. I think of all the things people should have asked him. I mean, it's easy things they should have asked him. I think, my goodness, why didn't they do that? And I don't think he's at a point he could even do it anymore. So.
Yeah. Well, listen, we really appreciate you coming on the show, and this has been a lot of fun. Why don't you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you and keep up with the books as you publish them?
Right. Best place is crowbarpress.com. Has a complete listing of all my books. I do make posters of famous wrestling cards, and I have all kinds of stuff old-time wrestling related on crowbarpress.com, and you can reach me. The easiest way is scott@crowbarpress.com.
Great. Thanks thanks again for doing this. It was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk. I love sharing my old experiences and talking about the old days. It's a lot of fun.
There it is, part two of our conversation with Scott Teal. Really had a lot of fun talking to him, Bix.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of almost like hearing about all the Gula stuff, it's like he's the other side of the coin to Jim Cornette in a way.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was talking to Jimmy the other day, and I said to him, oh, we have Scott Teal on, and he tells this story about how Lawler had been paying him $50 on the sly to write the programs. And when Jerry Jarrett found out, he put the kibosh on it because he said, that's a waste of money. And Cornette started laughing. He goes, yeah, that's when he realized I would do it for free. So it really is, you know, Scott Teal was doing all the things that Jim Cornette did before he was a manager. He did, you know, the photos, the gimmicks for sale, the programs. And like I said, I put up a couple of his slammograms. I know he talked about here with us, Bix, that the biggest program he remembered was Fargo against Hickerson and Condrey. I found a couple of those programs, so I'm going to put them online next day or so. Yeah. And I mean, also, you know, and I thought I was so glad you were ready with this. The talk about the lawsuit between Gulas and Fuller and Jarrett was fascinating stuff.
Yeah, I'd love to find out more about that stuff. It takes an investment to be able to get any of that old stuff. But I'd love to over there, just because it's just hidden history. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's why I want to know it. I mean, to me, one of the reasons we do this show is to try to, you know, find a way to find hidden history and then broadcast it so it's not hidden anymore. Yeah. So it's found history. I wonder if George Gulas has any old records or court transcripts or anything.
Maybe. Like, obviously one person that would have had it was Jim Wilson, but I would guess that his family probably just got rid of all of it after he died. because he had gotten copies of all of that stuff for his lawsuits, and that's why so much of that stuff is cited in one way or another in Chokehold.
You think Jim Wilson got copies of the Tennessee lawsuits?
Oh, he cites it. He cites it in the because there is a big there's a whole citation listing in that book. I mean, case numbers, everything.
I gotta order it already. I read it years ago, but it's like one of those books where, you know, half of you thinks Jim Wilson's full of shit. He was never going to be the NWA champion. I'm sure someone may have said that to him at some point as like a, you know, oh yeah, sure. But on the other hand, he has all this history and all these facts about these lawsuits that no one else has.
My feeling is that he's probably full of it on the Jim Wilson stuff. Jim Wilson is full of it on what happened to Jim Wilson, but generally not full of it on what he's talking about in the other, just the other stuff that's happening.
Do you think he's full of it on himself, or he truly believes the things he says about himself?
Well, because there are different layers to it. Like, does he really think that Jim Barnett had his dog murdered?
Okay, I forgot about that story. Okay.
Or that Jim Barnett cost him his, you know, his non-wrestling real estate job.
Yeah, okay.
I can believe. I don't know about the dog murdering.
The dog murdering sounds a little suspicious. Jim using whatever political connections he had in Atlanta to hurt an adversary, I could believe.
Right. But that's one of the must-read books. We should talk about it. You need to reread it. I mean, I've read it a million times. I probably should refresh on it.
I'm going to reread it. You're going to refresh on it. And then in a few weeks, we'll come back and make it our book of the week and have an extensive talk about it.
Yes. And very reasonably priced on Kindle, by the way. Like, it's – last I looked, it's maybe – $5-6.
I can't do that, though. I need to hold the book in my hands and add it to my collection.
Okay. Are you going to get the hardcover then?
Oh,
There's a hard and a soft cover.
That doesn't matter. To me, that's okay. I could go for a soft cover.
I think they were print on demand, though. So the quality of the jacket may not.
As long as it's not paperback sized, I'm good. I like to hold a nice full book in my hand and
It's not like pocket paperback size, but it's not. It's not huge format. You may want to get the hardcover, though.
How many pages is it?
It was over 400. It was like 450 or more.
Oh, okay, cool. Very cool. Very good. I guess the only other stuff similar to that in terms of researching a book is that NWA book. Who wrote it? Tim Hornbacker?
Yeah, there's overlapping in the research, too, because they both had – because Weldon Johnson – well, because I can't remember if he got some of the stuff on his own or he went through because this was Wilson's co-author. I can't remember if he got the stuff on his own and then compared notes with Wilson, or he got it from Wilson, because some of it was like his own separate research from a book he had written on his own. The whole thing's kind of confused.
Yeah.
I always liked that version of it better than the Hornbaker stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I always felt the Hornbaker stuff was a little too hard to read. I mean, a little too clinical.
Well, I was surprised with his new book, the one about the I think, is it Capital Rising or it's Capital – something
whatever.
Like
that. Oh, you mean the book that's supposed to be about the WWF but isn't really about the WWF?
Well, it's just so redundant with the NWA book in terms of the facts and the research. And then I thought it was going to be kind of like the rise of the McMahon Empire as it was purported to be. And it kind of isn't. It kind of isn't any of that stuff.
Yeah, I have a copy that was sent to me. I never really got all the way through it. What I was told, though, was that it lays out the NWA stuff better than his NWA book.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, you know this, but the listeners don't. There are two books I've always thought about writing. One of them I've actually actively researched, and I have a ton of research on it. And one of them is just an idea. But the one that was just an idea was going to be called it was going to be about the rise of Vince McMahon from 82 to 87. It'll end at WrestleMania 3, and it would just go into, you know, extreme detail about every single move he made. You know, everyone thinks that the invasions and the war started in 84. Go look back at 83. Go look back at everything he did in 83 and you'll realize he was making all of his moves right then and there. And that was something I wanted to do. But the other one, going back to 83, was I wanted to do a book about 1983 because I think it's one of the most fascinating years in wrestling history. And I've done a ton of research on it because if you really look at it, 83 is the peak year of the AWA. 83 is the peak year of world-class championship wrestling. 83 is a major year for Memphis.
Crockett.
83 is a major year for Crockett. The WWF isn't what it would become the next year, but the WWF, look at the business they're doing everywhere.
And they expand to California.
and they expand to California. And then you have all these little angles that are happening. You know, they go to Los Angeles. Los Angeles is dead. They go to San Francisco, which was where Vern was running. They go into Ohio, and Ole's in Ohio with Georgia Championship Wrestling, which is falling apart at the seams at that time. And Ole's advertising guys who aren't showing up. And then so they're now going at it in Ohio. And then there's that NWA convention that year, which has the confrontation between Ole Anderson screaming at the McMahons and the McMahons with their new ally, Jim Barnett, who Ole had just pushed out of Georgia Championship Wrestling, resign from the NWA and walk out of the meeting. That's the year the Road Warriors are invented. That's the year World Class Wrestling changes wrestling, because all of a sudden their crowds are full every week and it's filled with women screaming and yelling and kissing the wrestlers. It's like nothing anyone else had ever seen before. Portland has some cool stuff happening that year. Japan has great stuff that year, including the Terry Funk retirement, including New Japan imploding with the financial scandal. Tiger Mask now announces wrestling's fake and quits.
And writes a book about it.
And writes a book about it, leading to the formation of the first UWF. It's just, there's stuff happening everywhere.
Mexico's on fire.
Mexico's on fire. And, you know, major stars are going down there from America. Andre the Giant, Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan at that, you know, that's the peak of Hulkamania, you know, before the WWF. He's on fire with Vern. He's a major, major star. And then you have Florida, which, you know, it's interesting. World Class and Florida both start off the same way. Christmas night, 82, big angle. You know, with World Class, it's Kerry getting the cage door shut on his head by Terry Gordy. And in Florida, it is Dusty Rhodes against Kevin Sullivan, Loser Leaves Town. Jake Roberts, dressed up like Santa Claus, comes to ringside, costs Dusty the match. Dusty returns early 83 as the Midnight Rider, leading to the Night of the Mask, where Midnight Rider wins the NWA title from Ric Flair, but he won't unmask, so Bob Geigel refuses to allow him to have the championship. Like I said, I've done a lot of research on 83. Yes. It is, to me, one of the most fascinating years, if not the most fascinating year. So I kind of had an idea of like either doing an 83 standalone book or doing it as book one of a series called Wrestling War, where it would cover 83, 84, and 85. But right. I don't know. We'll see if anything ever happens with that.
And just to throw it in there, even Stampede, you know, they have their issues at the end of the year with the Stomper angle and how that all blows
right.
up.
I forgot about Stampede. Yeah.
But this is also right around when they're opening up Vancouver and doing amazing business there.
Yeah, so that's happening. Toronto, you know, is on the heels of Frank Tunney passing away. So Toronto's getting ready for a big switcheroo. Montreal's still running and running pretty hot that year. So, I mean, it's just – it's one of those years where almost everything is booming. And, you know – it's just – it's the most fascinating years in terms of behind-the-scenes political maneuverings. Of course, that's also the year where Mid-South Wrestling, the crowds start dwindling, and Bill Watts brings in Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler and asks them to watch a show. And, you know, should I say the cleaned-up version or the real version? But I'll say the real version. They looked at his crowds and they said, where are all the blowjobs?
And of Bill course, Watts said, well, if you wanted hookers, I would – get them yourself or whatever said, the line was.
I think the line was, hey, guys, you got to take care of that yourself. And they said, no, there's no women in your crowd. And then Watts went to Memphis in, I think, October of 83. I don't have my notes in front of me. And he goes there and he watches that show and he picks guys he wants. And he picks Jim Cornette and he picks the Midnight Express and he gets the Rock and Roll Express and Terry Taylor and he gets Bill Dundee's as Booker. And again, this is 83. They all go to Mid-South. Mid-South sends some talent to Memphis, but that also opens the door for the Poffo family to make communication with Jarrett and send Randy Savage in there at the end of 83, which begins that program. Again, everything's connected and everything rolls into the next year perfectly. So Maybe one day if I get enough interest and have enough time to do it right, because I would want, you know, I'm a big book guy, so I would want to really write it so it's not just like here's what happened. I would want to write it so that it reads really, really nicely. So,
and like you said, you know, with the NWA meeting and stuff, but a lot of stuff with the NWA imploding. But let's talk about a much more interesting and stronger time for the NWA, the late 90s.
Oh yeah, you know, someone wrote to me today and they asked me about it. They said tell me about, you know, when Dennis was the president of the NWA, and I had to say Dennis was never the president of the NWA. Dennis was only the most visible and active member of the NWA, and he chose not to be the president, although I think he had a couple opportunities to be. But for our Dennis of the Week this week, an extended Dennis of the Week, we talked with Rick Ratchett. If you had seen any of Dennis's shows between 95 and 2000, you would have seen Rick Ratchett. He did a Ric Flair knockoff gimmick. and it was quite entertaining with his manager, Donnie B, the brother of Nova from or Simon Dean, right? Was that his other name?
Yes, Simon Dean, the identical twin brother of
Yeah, and yeah. Donnie B, and both were good friends of mine. I had a lot of really good times with them back in the day. And also, I want to say in this conversation about Dennis, Rick Ratchet was one of the students, one of the trainees under Iron Mike Sharp.
Yeah.
So he passed away a few weeks ago, and I know we talked about it here on the show, but it also gave me an opportunity to ask someone who knew him during that period of his life a little bit about him. So you'll hear that too. And with that said, here is our conversation with Rick Ratchet. When I think back to all the good times I had years ago at Dennis Carluzzo shows, I think about the crew of friends that I ran around with, people like Mark Carluzzo and Donnie B. And one of them is with us today here on the program. It is my old friend Pete, better known to fans of Northeast Independent Wrestling as Rick Ratchet. Rick, Pete, whatever I'm calling you, how's it going today?
Woo! What's up, Brian? How you doing? Hey, man, I just want to say.
That is the worst woo. That is the worst woo. I love it.
That was like a half a woo. It was a woo. Listen, I haven't wooed in 15 years, so I'm not really that good at it anymore. But, you know, it's somewhat of a woo. I just want to say congratulations, by the way. You are the new co-host on the Jim Cornette Experience. It's a big deal.
Thank you.
That's a big deal, brother. You know,
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I love Jimmy. And, you know, when he came down and started working with us, you know, with Dennis, man, I got to tell you something. You know, we had all these guys that Dennis was bringing in that were like pretty big names. And the guy that made me fucking nervous was Cornette. Like, he walked in the locker room and I got like starstruck. Like, it was like, holy shit, Jim Cornette. He's in the fucking locker room. Meanwhile, I just like worked Sid the week before, you know? So what if, yeah, it was like, I don't know. There was just something about Jimmy, and then he would always kind of coach, and like he was just, you know, he's a real special guy. So I'm really happy to hear that you guys are working together, how things come around like that.
Well, we'll definitely get into later on your match with Sid, your famous match with Sid.
Oh, God, yeah.
But before we get going with that, I guess for people who don't know you or aren't aware of you, you wrestled for, I want to say, from 95 to around 2000 for Dennis. You were Rick Ratchet, which is it fair to say a Ric Flair spoof gimmick? It's not even a knockoff. It was kind of a little bit of a spoof. How would you put it? How would you describe Rick Ratchet?
Well, you know, it was kind of funny. When I got into the business, the guys that I looked up to mostly were Heenan and Flair. I mean, those were like – those were the two that I watched all the tapes on. And Heenan when he was a worker, you know. So Heenan and Flair were like the two when I was studying and trying to train and do everything. Like I really kind of picked up on there's some kind of entertainment aspect. So when I started wrestling, I just started working like Flair, you know, like kind of even like bumping fucked up, you know, doing the same fucked up. Everything that I was doing, I was doing the same thing. So – I wasn't doing like a nature boy or anything like that from the beginning until I'd gotten to Dennis. And Dennis said, hey, asshole, if you're going to do Flair, do fucking Flair. Just don't do half a Flair. Do Flair like you're out of your mind. Like do a complete Mark gimmick. And I said, wow, you know, that's all right. I'll just do the whole fucking thing. I'll come out to the music. I'll do the whole deal, right? So I came out to the music. I was 16 time, blah, blah, blah. The whole fucking deal. Like, I ripped it off so bad. I mean, it was like, I mean, we did it, but it was almost like a delusional Flair, which was like, which made it very funny to the point where, like, I had Beth come in and interfere in one of my matches. And David came down to ringside with me and Reed, you know, God rest his soul, but Reed came down to ringside with me at one match. I mean, all this funny shit that people would see on TV and then see me do it, that this guy must be out of his fucking mind. And that's how it really, really got over. Like me thinking that I was him. And I still fuck with the guys to this day and tell them, oh, you know, when I used to work Harley Race, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, like just stupid shit. But it was really Dennis was kind of like the guy that pushed me into that direction. And Cornette did as well. Then just fucking do it and do a Mark gimmick. And I was actually saying, well, it could be really funny because I could be like, I could do Flair one time and, you know, somebody else could walk in or you could do like some kind of like, like some kind of like, you know, if you had TV of some kind where you could put it over, you know, another big wrestler could come in and say hi to me and then just say if it was Piper, and then all of a sudden I come out next week in a kilt. You know, it could be like a funny, like a guy, the guy's crazy. He's just the fucking mark and he's doing everybody's gimmicks. So I don't know. It was kind of funny, and that's how the whole thing started. And yeah, I mean, God, before I knew it, like most of the shows, Dennis had put me with a lot of the older guys, and I, you know, I didn't do any high flying shit. You know, I didn't do anything to get anybody hurt. So, you know, I started getting like a name with a lot of guys because I could socialize, and people, you know, were always willing to put me over and sell for me or do whatever the fuck it was. Or, you know, Dennis gave me the belt and, you know, whatever. I ran a deal with Severn and a bunch of guys, like really try to help people on the entertainment aspect of the side. If there was anything that I got in the business, it certainly wasn't athleticism. It was just entertainment.
You know, you mentioned that you worked with a lot of the old guys. I actually remember I did commentary one time for Dennis, and the match was Rick Ratchett and Felipe the Pool Boy against the Fabulous Moolah and Mae Young.
Oh man, fuck. Dennis was fucking marking out for that for weeks. Oh my God. You know, and Moolah was so great. You know, she gets in the ring and we're doing, I said, sweetheart, you just do whatever the fuck you want. We'll have a great time. Don't worry about nothing. Those two kicked the living shit out of us. They kicked the shit out of us so bad that I couldn't contain myself. I was laughing so damn hard. Mae Young scooted – Felipe was outside the ring. He was running around the bottom. And, you know, she did this – she does this like shoot drop kick through the ropes. Granted, she's 81 years old at this time, right? She does this shoot drop. She hit him so fucking hard. He fell back into the railing. I'm telling you, harder than anybody. I mean, she nailed him. And then, you know, but she didn't know because she just, her judgment was off a little bit. We'll give her a little bit of leeway. She's 81. Then, you know, we get in the ring and fucking, she gets me in the corner and she goes to, I said, you know, lay some punches on me, chop me, do something. So she gets in the corner and she goes to lay a punch on me and she lands it right, like she punches me square in the fucking jaw. And I start bleeding down the side of my jaw. And she goes, oh my God, I made you bleed. I'm so sorry. And I'm like, where is this vicious woman that I knew when I was a kid that I was terrified of? Oh man, I mean, it was just, you know, completely different, but it was really, really good. I enjoyed working with them. I did a lot of stuff with them. We ran like four or five matches with them, and after that, the WWE saw it and was like, or WWF at the time. That's how old I am. But WWF, they took it and started using them and having Bubba put them through tables and shit like that. So, which, you know, I don't know. It was okay. Could have got him over. You didn't have to do that much to get him over.
I remember when Brian gave me the tape of that show to convert to DVD because it had the commentary. And Brian was telling me about it. He was watching it with his girlfriend at the time. And she says to him, this isn't as good as that Ric Flair stuff you showed me.
Yeah. Yeah, it was weird. It was just fucked up. It was just so fucked up. And then I worked the gimmick all night. I'd work it in the locker room and think I was Flair, and I'd come in with the comb and, you know.
You even worked as the Black Scorpion once.
Yes, I did do the Black Scorpion. That was funny. That was funny. You know what? That's a good Cornette story. So Cornette tells me distinctly in the match, he says, Ratchett, at the end of the match, make sure you take the can and you put the fucking can up into your mask. And I said, you know, okay, but you got to put it through the eye hole, Ratchett. If you pick the mask up, it's going to fall the fuck out. And I said, all right, no problem. Well, I completely forget it. And I get in the ring and I go to pull a mask up, go put it in. And when I drop the mask, the fucking gimmick falls out. Like, you know, there's the finish, you know. Yeah. So now, yeah, I put it through the eye hole, and then I hit Donnie, knocked him out, or whoever. I forgot who the fuck I wrestled that. Now, you know what?
I think it was Donnie. I think it was
Donnie. Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and then I put it back in. I fucking knocked him out, whatever. And then because we were doing this like heel angle fucking turn, whatever stupid shit that we were doing, and Cornette's just waiting for me, you know, and I'm like, fuck, I just go out the front door right now. And he goes, oh, you stupid fuck. I told you to put it through the eye hole. Don't lift the goddamn mask up. And I was like, well, I forgot. And I was thinking, how am I going to get everybody to see who I am? I wanted them to see my face. And he's like, well, we could have done it another way, you dumb fuck. Now get out of my face. All right. I love you.
You know, you mentioned Donnie, and two of the things I remember about when I first saw you, and one of those things that carried on was, one, Donnie B was your manager, and he was bigger than you, and two, was your name was Rick Ratchet, which would always produce a sea of children yelling, "Rat shit, rat shit." It was the most easy heat name I've ever heard in my
life. Oh, yeah, yeah. It was, yeah, that, you know what's so funny about that was Donnie, you know, so smart, you know, like just absolutely so fucking smart as a manager. I never would have done half the shit that I would have done, or got half the heat that I would have had if it wasn't for him. Donnie would be outside the ring and he would look at somebody in the crowd, turn around, and he says, "Don't you call him rat shit. It's not rat shit." And that's how it would start. That would get the whole section going, you know? And shit, man, when I had the guy in a rest hold, Donnie'd be sitting there beating on the fucking mat, you know? "Come on, Ratchet, get him, boom, boom." And then the baby face kicked the leg, and then the crowd would come up, boom, 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 and then everybody just go fucking crazy. It was just all psychology, you know? But as I would get the shit kicked out of me during the match, Donnie would also fall apart as well. His shirt tail would come out, his tie would come undone. He would slowly degrade as I was getting my ass kicked, so it would appear from a psychological standpoint that, oh, he's going to lose, you know, and then it just do some kind of fuck finish. I never won clean. I never thought I should.
Yeah.
No heel should ever go over clean, you know, especially back then. Now it's different because the lines are all blurred, but, you know, I mean, that was, you know, he was a very, and, you know, he was a good friend too, you know, so I don't know what I would have done without him, and I still talk to him every day, so.
You know, I mentioned before that I think the first time I remember you working for Dennis, NWA New Jersey, was 95. Mm-hmm. Do you remember what was actually – when was the first time you met Dennis, and what were your initial thoughts of him?
Well, you know, when I met Dennis, he was just really nice to me. And he just took a liking to me. And not only did he take a liking to me, but he kind of like – I mean, he like took me under his wing, you know, like almost like as his son. You know, and me and his son Dennis were fairly close in age, and you know, he really took me under his wing, and he helped me with a lot of shit that was going on in my life because I was crazy and I did a lot of fucked up shit. He'd help me with some legal stuff that I was getting into, and like, he just helped me in every way. I talked to him every day. I helped him with every show, no matter what he did. Whatever you need, I'll do it. You know, I didn't care. You know, that was till the end. You know, even after all the shit with Gino Moore and all those fucking scumbags, all those guys that screwed him over with the NWA stuff, I was just, you know, I was more upset than he was. And, yeah. You know, obviously, you know, those kinds of things I think were I think it's kind of what led to his demise, to be honest with you. You know, there was a downward spiral that happened to him that was triggered by those guys. And things weren't handled the way they should have been, and it just went downhill for him, and we were all there. But you know, and I tell him, "Dennis, don't worry about it. Who gives a shit? You know, I'll give you. We'll get whatever we got to do, and we'll come back, and everything will be fine. You know, we'll do our own shit. Don't worry about it." So, but you know, at the time he was in the hospital, he got pretty sick, and then it was kind of over. So, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, I can't imagine anyone wouldn't think that Dennis was done wrong by his former partners and screwed out of his own company. And, you know, when you said Dennis helped you out of a lot of tough times, I actually thought you were talking about when you had the frosted tips in your hair, that mistake.
The frosted tips in my hair, that was just another fucking deal where Dennis just, you know, that was another, like, you know, all the heel shit that we did to each other, that was one of them. Like, he just made me do that. He's like, "You know what, you got to bleach your hair blonde if you're going to fucking do it." I'm like, "Bleach my hair blonde. I'm like darker than a Mexican guy. You're going to make me bleach my hair blonde. It's not going to look right." No. It'll look great. You know? Sure. And I'll just go along right with it like just some fucking mark. And then I go and I do it and bleach my hair and everybody's just laughing. I'm like, "You're such an asshole." You know?
How did you first get booked by Dennis? What was your road to getting in there?
Well, you know, I was wrestling at the time for Dino Sana, and I was the champ in, for the WWWA, which is a little league out in Pennsylvania. And he does some small little spot independent shows, you know, flea markets, all that shit, you know, high schools. And he would draw, too. He did pretty good, too. You know, they all did good back then. I mean, we would draw 2,000-3,000 people a show. I mean, we were doing pretty good. He'd bring in one name. I'd work the name. Everybody else, they have a nice little undercard. And that was it. And that's all you had to do. And, you know, me and Donnie get the fucking the name over during the match. It was always a baby face. We always worked heel. And then that was it. And it was just, do we go home? And, you know, I did that for a long time with Dino. And then I don't know. If I'm not mistaken, it might have been Tommy Fierro was the one that was like they came to a couple of shows and saw me working. And we kind of became friends. And he knew us through Sharps too. And, you know, that was kind of like, you got to see this guy work. He's really funny, you know. So.
Well, you mentioned Sharp. So before we go back to Dennis, you know, Iron Mike Sharp just recently passed away, something we talked about here on the program. And you were one of those guys in Jersey that was trained by Iron Mike Sharp. What are your memories of him, of being in that gym with the other students? And tell us a little bit about the man that you knew, Iron Mike Sharp.
Mike was a sweetheart. I mean, Mike had such a great heart. And if anything, that was kind of like his crutch where people, like I'd always see people maybe take advantage of him, you know. And when he was running the school or whatever, that was just the one thing. Because he was just that nice of a guy, you know. And Mike was really smart from a coaching standpoint because he was the one, he'd always yell, look at the people, make sure you look at the people, look at the people, pay attention to the people. Don't, who gives a shit about that fucking move? You pay attention to the people. That was his thing, you know. And when you watched Mike work, Mike was a great worker. You know, I mean, he really was. If they put a belt on him and put him over, I think Mike could have been, you know, one of your top 10 guys in the business. I think he would have been that over. And I'm not saying it to be biased. I just think that he was just that good because he was so loud, you know? Like, he'd get around, but the whole place would light up. They could hear him. So, you know, I think his influence on the entertainment aspect really, really had an influence on everybody that went to that school. So whether it was Donnie or Nova or Devin or Ken Porter or Danny Giamondo, Inferno Kid or Stevie Richards or Taris Meraldo, Dorsey, all those guys. I mean, they were all really good at entertaining, you know, and that's what it was about. And, you know, this is like pre-kayfabe, you know, so like, you know, after kayfabe was broken, everything changed, right? When sports entertainment, that kind of fucked everything up. But before that, I mean, when you could get away with these storylines and it was a very clear heel, a very clear baby face, if you knew what the fuck you were doing, you could get over really easy, you know? I mean, I was, you know, everybody in the crowd probably, I mean, I weighed 200 pounds when I wrestled. Probably half the people in the crowd could have kicked the shit out of me and they knew they could. And I wanted them to think that. That's why I always cheated. You know, that's how you get over. You know, everybody think they can kick the shit. You chicken shit. Do the chicken shit stuff. I mean, it's like you can do that all day long and, you know, playing up to psychology. And that was one of the things that Mike was always like, you know, always pushing a whole lot at the school. And you know, the students always trained. You know, they always trained me and they helped me as much as they could because I couldn't even throw a fucking drop kick. But beside the point, I could work a donut hole better than anybody. You know, so it was just one of those things, you know. But, like, I think that, you know, if anything, it brought a lot of really good guys together at different points in our lives. We all kind of moved up or went down one way or another. Like, Mike went to ECW and Porter went to ECW. And Giamondo, he was working for WWE for a while. And Richards, of course, he was there. Christ, I think Steve Richards was in the WWE longer than anybody. I don't think there was anybody in there longer than him. But yeah, I mean, we just had a lot of really good guys. You know, we all kind of helped each other. So, and the Sharp was all a big part of that. But as a person, God, you know, it was so weird. 2 weeks before he passed, I was talking to Donnie. I'm like, Donnie, we got to fucking find him. I mean, maybe there's something wrong and we can't help him. I said, if anything, I just want to make sure he's okay. And if he needs anything, I'll fucking give it to him. I don't care, you know? He's like, well, let me see what I can do. Well, you know, he's a cop and he can only get so far in the system. He can't get into Canada. So that was the line that we couldn't.
Oh, yeah.
That's how we didn't know he was in Hamilton. If we were in Hamilton, I would have flew there and found him somehow. But yeah, and who the hell knew, like 63 or 64, whatever he was, that he would, you know. I think, you know, I'm not for sure, Brian, but I actually think at one point in time, I think that Mike had been in some type of accident, and that's why he was in a wheelchair. There's no way that Mike wouldn't have been in a wheelchair had there not been an accident. He had to have fucked himself up somehow, like a car accident or something. I don't know. But because they said when they found him, he was in a wheelchair. So, and Mike was in shape, you know, like he would be at the school and it was so funny because we'd drive by like 3 a.m, 2 a.m or whatever. And Mike would be in there like doing cables and push-ups and he'd be doing all kinds. I mean, he was like really, you know, really into like physical fitness. He'd blow anybody up in the ring. He could work a fucking 4-hour Broadway and not blow up. I mean, the guy was just, you know, he was phenomenal. He had phenomenal wind in the ring, probably because he was so relaxed too when he was in there. But you know, the funny thing with Mike, the funny part about him was, you know, the OCD stuff, which we've all heard the OCD stories.
Yeah.
You know, with the germs and stuff, you know, getting leg got locked in convention hall one night in Asbury Park and just some funny shit. Oh, my God. You know, but he would be like that at the school, too. There was a shower there and he would, you know, take long showers there and he would, you know, make sure he always had the soap and he'd be the germ stuff and he'd run it all over his hands. And I never figured it out. You know, I didn't even think twice about it, you know, but yeah, I know he worked the show with somewhere and he was taking showers so long. He was the main event. By the time he got out, he's taking a shower so long, they closed the lights and locked him in the fucking building.
I think it happened more than once because I think it happened in Boston too, I want to say.
It might have. Yeah, I think it did happen more than once. Yeah. And I could never figure out. Like I never – you know, the one thing that I never knew about the personal stuff with Mike was, well, where the fuck did he live when we had the school in Brick? And I think Mike was just kind of living on the road then. I don't know what he was doing. I know he was saving his money. He was a big saver. But I don't know what he was doing with his time, where he was going. But he would just go from show to show to show to show and live in hotels, I think. Yeah. But we had a good school. We had – I think we probably had 40 or 50 kids down there at one point.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier your – famous match with Sid Vicious. Tell us the story behind that.
Oh, well, you know, Dennis started using Sid on the shows, you know.
Right, in like 98. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, when he booked him on the show, the first thing that came to my mind was, this is the guy that fucking stabbed Arn Anderson. Because that story was just so famous, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I went in the locker room and he was all alone. Nobody was even going near him, you know. And it was probably like 10 or 15 minutes went by and I went up to him and I said, hey, listen, man, you know, we don't really allow any stabbings on these shows. So just, you know, kind of chill the fuck out with that shit. And he looked at me and says, motherfucker, you crazy son of a bitch. And he like shook my hand and I sat down and talked with him for probably 2 hours, you know, and we got along so good, you know, and nobody, everybody else is always like very scared of him. But there was a side to Sid that a lot of people didn't know. And that I really loved, you know. I mean, the guy was really probably did more for me than most people in the business ever did. He was working for WWE at the time. And then Dennis was using him on all these shows, and then he'd come up to me on one of the shows and said, "Ratchet, come here." And now we'd been hanging out. Every time he came in, we'd hang out for a couple days. Matter of fact, I took him to my manufacturing plant when he came down for a show that we had in Middletown. Before he came to the show, I took him to my plant and I showed him everything we do because I was at a low-carbohydrate food company at the time and, you know, showed him all our manufacturing stuff and everything. So we were close on a personal level too. And then, you know, we did a couple shows here and there. But then as time grew on and our relationship got better, he said, "Ratchet, I'm gonna do you a big favor tonight." And I said, "Well, what?" And he goes, "Don't tell anybody. I'm switching the matches for the main event." And I said, "Well, what the fuck?" I said, it's already booked, you know? And he says, No. He says, "Listen, I was supposed to work Mabel and he was supposed to work Mabel and I was gonna work Kevin Knight." He said, "Let's just switch it. Put Mabel with Kevin and put you with me." And I said, "All right, yeah, we'll have some fun. We're going in and have some fun. We'll cheat the whole fucking time." So Donnie leaves. This is the worst thing that Donnie ever did in his life. He leaves. And I'm like, "Well, I need a fucking manager," but he doesn't know that I'm wrestling Sid yet. So he doesn't even know what happened because this happened like maybe 10, maybe 15 minutes before the two matches where Sid went up to him and said, "Hey, I want to switch both matches. I want to work." And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, definitely. Fuck, you work Ratchet, it'll be hilarious." So the master was there, Rocco Mazza. And I said, "Brother, I need you. I said, I can't do this fucking match by myself. I said, he'll kill me. You know, we'll have to do something to look good." Well, I get in the ring. And he says, so then he tells me, he goes, "You know, listen, I want to put you over." He said, "By tomorrow, your name's going to be in all the fucking sheets." And I says, you don't do that. I said, you're just going to piss everybody off down in fucking WWF and do all. He said, no, I don't give a fuck about them. Fuck them, as a matter of fact. I'm going to play softball. All right, whatever. Sounds good to me. So we get in there and cut a promo in the beginning or whatever and go back and forth. And then he just starts selling the whole fucking time. And I keep telling him to get up. I'm like, get up, you know, get a comeback or do something. And he's just laying down the whole fucking match. And he's like barely getting any heat on me. He just wanted to do a comeback and go home. And that was it. So, you know, Maz is cheating and Sid is selling for the whole fucking match, you know. And I'm like, what the fuck? This looks so unrealistic right now. I'm just trying everything I can do to just cheat and make it look like I'm just fucking over. And there's no possible way that if I didn't cheat that this guy would fucking kill me. So anyway, and then the match comes around. And I used to carry real brass knuckles to the ring with me. That was my gimmick. Like I would always have Donnie throw me brass knuckles or whatever. And I'd have him throw them real high and I'd catch them and they'd be real. And I'd fucking hit the guy right in the head with them. But at the last second I'd turn my hand so that when my hand my wrist would hit them. You know, so that when I hit them in the head, their head would go back. It looked like I fucking really did it, you know. Yeah. So he goes, go get the brass knuckles, Ratchet. And he gets up and I fucking get the brass knuckles and I fucking knock him out and he's out. Nobody knows in the entire locker room that I was supposed to go over in that match. We fucking screwdrived everybody, right? And I just 1, 2, 3. The only guy that knew was the ref. That was it. And it just everybody's like, what the fuck just happened? And the announcer's not even like ready to like, you know, say that I won. You know, he's like hesitant. He's like, new champion, Rick Ratchet. And I'm like this is like dead silence. Like if there was a cricket walking through that fucking place, you would have heard him. That's how dead silent it was. Everybody was just so shocked. And sure as shit, man. The next day, it was all over the fucking – all over the internet, all over the sheets. It was all over everything, you know, and I'm like, fuck. So I call him up the next day. I'm like, brother, you ain't shitting this fucking – so he said, see, I told you. Watch how much heat you get now. And then that kind of changed everything at that point on because I think people kind of like – everyone, no one could figure out why he wanted to put me over. Some people say I gave him head or whatever the fucking case may be. I don't give a shit. He gets on all kinds of gross details. But the fact was we did have a really – close personal friendship, and it was just you know I'd always hook him up with supplements, take care of him with shit and protein powders and this and that, and we had a very big fitness background too, so we were both kind of like, you know, into fitness a whole lot, and I was helping him with stuff, so you know, I mean, it was just like one of those things. And I was friends with a lot of the older guys in the business that were, you know, trying their best to do stuff. I always did everything I could to help everybody, you know. But yeah, so I mean, you know, that's how it happened. And that was like the whole story. And then sure as shit, I was doing dark matches for WWF. Like, I don't know, like 6 months later. Yeah.
Is there a tape of the Sid match?
Yeah, there is. You know who's got it? Mike Bucci's got it. Yeah, he's got it. We'll have to extract it from him somehow. It's probably on some ancient form of video. It's probably a VHS, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely is. Is it a DVD?
Going back to Dennis, you know, are there any, you know, you mentioned before we started that you may have had some Dennis stories that weren't necessarily funny, or if you have any funny ones, we'd like to hear those as well. But, you know, just tell us some stories about Dennis, about the guy you knew.
Yeah, I mean, as far as like personally for me, what Dennis did, whatever I asked, and he helped me with it. You know, if it was money and I needed help, when I tore my ACL, Dennis did the gimmick on. I tore my ACL not wrestling. I did it training, and we went to a show, and he says, "Okay, just take care. We'll take care of it at the show and use the insurance at the show." I didn't have the money to take care of him back then to take care of my leg, and he got me the surgery.
Wow, so, I didn't know that. I actually didn't know that story.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's just and that's all personal stuff. That didn't have anything to do with anything. You know,
it's just his character. It was the kind of guy he was.
Yeah, you know, and you know, I'll tell you another story he did for me. So I didn't have money back then to even get car insurance. This is just so funny. I mean, you know, I'm grateful every day for what I have now. I'm doing very well. But back then I didn't have anything. And you know, I didn't even have car insurance. So Dennis, I got pulled over by the cops. Cops is, you know, you know, where's your insurance card? Oh, I don't have one. I left it home, I guess. So I get a ticket for not having documentation, right?
Yeah.
So I told Dennis what happened, and he says, don't worry about it, Ratchet. He goes, let me tell you something. I said, dude, it's the third time it's happened. I'm going to go to jail. And he goes, no, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. And I go, what the fuck are you going to do? And he goes, I'll get you insurance and I'll backdate it. I guess you could do it back then. He got me insurance, backdated it. I went to court. I showed the judge. I said, here's the insurance. The judge's like, well, okay, let him go. That's it. Didn't even pay a dollar. Saved my ass again, you know.
You could do so many things before everything was, you know, done on a computer.
Yeah. So, you know, so, you know, you fast forward now and boy, you know, you really appreciate it as you get older. Yeah. I appreciated it then, but I really appreciated it now.
You know, you brought up Dennis's funeral, and the one thing I remember, it was a very emotional day for me just because it was so sudden and he was someone who was so much a part of my life. And I remember sitting at the funeral during the service, and the priest is giving a speech about Dennis. And, you know, I knew Dennis very, very well. I certainly didn't know Dennis as a church-going guy. I'm not saying that he was or wasn't.
No, he wasn't. No,
it's just I didn't know him as that. But apparently there was a time where he somewhat regularly went to church, because in the middle of the priest's speech, the fact that he knew the name of the publication was just – it cracked me up. He goes, and I remember sometimes I'd be surprised. I would see Dennis sitting out there holding his Bible –
reading. Bullshit.
Well, listen. He goes, holding his Bible and thoroughly reading it. And sometimes he was reading it, you know, he was so into reading it that he didn't notice that I was walking behind him. And inside the Bible was something called the Wrestling Observer Newsletter.
What?
Yeah. So apparently Dennis would,
oh my God,
when he was in church, he would stick the Observer inside the Bible. So while he was holding the Bible, he'd be reading the Observer, and the priest busted him.
Oh shit. I, you know what? I don't know. You know, fuck. Dennis is about as religious as Jim Cornette is. So I don't know exactly. I don't know if he actually believed in all that shit. I know I'm probably pretty much on the same pace with all that.
Well, I guess, to wrap up the interview portion of our talk here, you know, what are your closing thoughts? What are your, you know, how do you want to see Dennis remembered?
Well, you know, I'd love to see him remembered as the guy that really was the good-hearted guy. And there were a bunch of us that saw that, felt that, you know. And then, you know, but the problem is in this world and what we live in, and everybody just remembers you for the bad shit, you know. It's just the way it is, and I think there's always going to have that stigma that's kind of associated with it. But I just think that there's enough people in the business that really, really knew Dennis. And you know what? Dennis don't give a fuck what you think about him anyways or how he's remembered. I know he doesn't give a fuck. I know that the ones that he cared about are the ones whose opinions matter, you know. And so I think, like, for you, me, Donnie, you know, his family – that's what he cares about. I mean, that's the legacy, you know. I mean, that, like, the people that he left behind that he made into better people, you know. And you know, I'm so grateful that I had him in my life. You know, I'm grateful for a lot of things, but that's one of the things that I'm really, really grateful for. And you know, I was so glad that, you know, I was able to, you know, have him for the time that I had him. I wish I just could have had him longer, you know. One of those things.
So that was Rick Ratchet. Nice chat right there. I cannot get over the story about Dennis reading the Observer in church.
You know, I remember when the priest said that story. You know, it was a very tough day. It was a sad day. And when he said that, everyone who was there related to wrestling had to just chuckle and smile. And I remember that was like the one moment I got to, like, you know, smile and laugh during the funeral proceedings. And that was, you know, I say it every time. There was no one like Dennis. Dennis was just, you know, a singular man. He was a very, very unique guy. And, you know, I miss him to this day. He used to say that he talked to Dave Meltzer all the time. I wonder, what Dave would say for a Dennis of the Week.
That would be interesting. That's a topic we need to pursue.
Yeah. How about the story of Sid putting Ratchet over? I can't get over his woo at the beginning. Woo!
The Denizen Church story reminds me, because I have a story, but do you have any, weird stories of, encountering the Observer or any sheets or whatever outside of wrestling environments and all of a sudden, coming across someone, reading someone, somewhere where you wouldn't have expected?
I don't, but I remember when I was a teenager, my dad, would pay for my subscription to the Observer, and he was the one who turned me on to Dave Meltzer because he read the National. He was a subscriber to the National.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I first found out about who Dave Meltzer was, even before I heard him on a resi, was through the National, because my dad's a huge sports guy. And one day my dad, I think it was before I became friends with the guy. So it must have been when I was 14. My dad was on the train going to the office, on the subway, going from Penn Station down to the office. And he sees someone reading the Observer, some kid. Mm-hmm. And my dad just, says something. He's like, "Oh, you're reading Dave Meltzer?" And the kid was stunned that anyone knew who Dave Meltzer was. And that was Ben Lagerstrom, years before I became friends with Ben.
I think I might have told you this story once, just talking. I can't remember. So a handful of times in junior high, as a substitute gym teacher, I had Mr. London, who was former PWI writer and photographer Roy London.
Wait, what?
Yes.
Wait, which school?
At Long Beach Middle School.
I don't remember this guy.
Well, I didn't see him around much. It was only a few times, but I don't even remember how it came up. Was I wearing a wrestling shirt, whatever? And we ended up the other times he'd sub talking about wrestling. And then one time I remember he just got the Observer from the car and gave me his Observer to read during gym.
Wow, that's awesome.
And he had a bunch of stories, of course. I feel like trying to remember if I've ever tried to find him on Facebook or something. I feel like I asked Apter once if he was in touch with him or anything. But yeah, I mean, that's one of my more wacky, just random wrestling outside of wrestling, so to speak, stories that he just popped up as the substitute gym teacher on and off.
When I was in high school, I used to get kicked out of the library all the time for causing trouble. I used to go there during my lunch break. I would go to the library and, I don't know. I would end up getting kicked out.
And what would you do? Because the high school library is massive. How did you get detected causing trouble?
Well, I would get in trouble sometimes for talking other people into doing things. Or even if I didn't, if someone did something, somehow I became – there was this one kid who he just wanted to hang out with us and – we didn't even ask him to do it, but he would just start doing things to make us laugh. So he would walk into one of the aisles of books where no one could see him and just start throwing books in the air and making bird noises. And they kicked him out, and they kicked me out because I was laughing so hard they thought I put him up to it. I was like, I didn't have anything to do with it. They kicked me out. But I got kicked out enough and sent to the dean's office that I ended up having a really nice relationship with the deans in Long Beach High School. they were all very understanding because they realized that I was actually intelligent. I wasn't just a troublemaker. And one of the deans was this guy, Mr. Emmons. And we got along great. He was very supportive of me, very, very cool. And one day after a break or something, he called me into his office. I was like, "What's up?" He's like, "I just was down in Florida, and there was a show, and there were these guys signing autographs, and there were wrestlers, so I got you this." And he gave me an autographed photo of Stan Lane with the Fabulous Ones. So it's just Stan Lane, though, autographed. And Vladimir Koloff, the bootleg Koloff. it was like, "Oh, thanks so much. It's nice."
The real Stan Lane?
It was the real Stan Lane, I assume. I think it was. And it was Vladimir Koloff. Those are the two autographs he got me.
Wow. That's my dad would get me autographs and stuff when he'd go to NATP, the syndication convention. Because he'd go by the WWF booth or the WCW booth or whatever. And, he'd always bring home interesting trinkets. I remember once I used to have an envelope full of the gold and purple WCW logo?
The cards?
Well, no, the logo. They had these lapel pins. And once he
really?
Got a thing full of these lapel pins, and I had a dozen of them.
I wish you still had those.
And I do too. God, I wish I could remember what else there was over there. I remember I already had a Have a Nice Day. He got me an autographed copy that they had that they were giving out at the WWF booth. I wish I could remember all this stuff. Autographed photos to him of Bret Hart and Alundra Blaze. just stuff like that. And I wish he had some press kits. That would have been cool to have that type of thing.
I got a press kit of WWF from WrestleMania 10 around there. I mean, it seems like they made it old. It seems like it's a few years old by that point, but I have that. Mm-hmm. I'll let you see that. You know, one of the coolest things in my collection is Masahori once sent this to me as a gift, and it was one of the nicest things. It's an autographed copy of Terry Funk's Japanese biography.
Mm.
You know, years before he did one in America, he did one in Japan, and it's signed. Help me read the inscription. I keep it next to my desk.
Stay out of jail.
Hey, Brian, I'll bet this is going to be a tough read for you since it's in Japanese. Good luck and God bless you and the family, Terry Funk.
I really wish because there must be English manuscripts of those. Why have none of those been turned into English books?
I don't know.
Because there are a bunch, right?
I think so.
Wasn't there a separate – there was a separate Thez biography that why am I forgetting his name all of a sudden?
Kit Bauman?
No, the Japanese guy who was Thez's biographer in Japan.
Oh, I have one of those. I actually have one of those giant Thez books that with the gold cover.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, pictures of Thez and pictures of Strangler Lewis and, you know, different things in Japanese. So I can't read what any of it is. Reprints of programs and everything. I have one of those books. I got that years ago. Georgia Macropoulos gave it to me. Yeah. Like you brought up the book. Is it Kayfabe? Is that the Tiger Mask book?
Yeah, but my point being, though, the books of American wrestlers that I presume were originally written in English because most of them were memoirs. They were autobiographies. I mean, even if it's, you know, it's ghost-written, Stan Hansen. I remember seeing that one at Kinokuniya once in the city.
What year? I mean, is it one of those things where if he wrote the book himself, that could be like the something that he would later send to Scott Teal to put out?
I don't know. I want to say I saw it. I think it would have been whenever I got – they did that great – that Champions magazine that had Muto on the cover when he had like six different belts at the same time. So that's like 2002, 2003.
Okay. So that's not far off from when that book would have come out in America.
Well, no. The Hansen book's pretty recent.
Is it? It's
American – the Scott's is within the last 5 years.
I'm looking it up right now. The power of the internet and the this is compelling radio right
yeah,
here.
Yeah, anyway, we're going on all sorts of tangents, which is good, but I know it's just – now these days I try not to have too much stuff, but I still – wish I had some of the other stuff and the you know, one thing I can't remember if it was on part one or part two, Scott Teal was talking about Boyd Pierce's stuff, wasn't he?
Yeah, that was part one.
And I remember years ago Tom Burke used to sell like grab bags on eBay. He just threw together different programs, newsletters, whatever. And one of them was a little key holder type, you know, those rubber key holder things?
Yeah.
And it was one. It was for Boyd Pierce, but it did not say Pro Wrestling King of Sports. It was actually an ad for his business that made the Pro Wrestling King of Sports stuff, and it said, you know, it was Boyd Pierce souvenirs or whatever.
It looks like the Stan Hansen book is 2011.
See, I said last 5 years.
You're right. Okay, you're right. You're right. When you're right, you're right. And you sometimes you're right.
And on that note,
I guess you should go with your plugs first.
Should I?
Yeah, why not?
You've got some good. You got a good plug this week. Why don't you go first?
All right. Well, starting this week, I am the co-host of the Jim Cornette Experience on MLWRadio.com. You can hear me every week on there with Jim. We definitely do a bunch of classic wrestling talk as well as some contemporary wrestling talk. And, of course, it being Jim, we take a dive into the political waters briefly. But check that out, MLWRadio.com. I had a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to upcoming weeks with that. And I hope you get a chance to listen to it, Bix. I think you'll like it, too. Some really fun stuff we talk about this week about Jim and the Fabulous Ones, as well as the famous match from the first Clash of the Champions, the Fantastics against the Midnight Express. Maybe at that time, in 1988, excuse me, the wildest match ever on national television for professional wrestling. You be the judge, but please listen to that. As always, you can stay in touch with us on Facebook, facebook.com/superpodcast. tinyurl.com/605Amazon for our Amazon link. On Twitter, you can use our hashtag. We'll do our Twitter names at the end, but you can use our hashtag 605pod to stay in touch with the show. And Bix, now it's your turn.
All right. I you can save the group stuff for the end. We can switch off our own stuff. We should be plugging all the show stuff together. It's unified. Unified front.
Was that I don't know what you just said.
I don't either.
Okay.
What you think I think these things through before I say them? Really? Have that high an opinion of me?
What are we supposed to have this unity for?
I have no clue.
All right. Bix. Now I'm worried that you're not going to be able to deliver your plugs. Should I get the alarm out again?
Well, because I got a new one this week, though.
I got a really good alarm if you go over the 60 seconds.
Is this the Black Magic?
No, that's actually not the Black Magic alarm. Well, that's the Black Scorpion. It's not me. But this is just the Bix alarm.
Oh, really? It's not.
Obviously, the Black Scorpion is Rick Ratchet. It's not me. but this is the Bix alarm.
Did Rick have to get a haircut to be the Black Scorpion?
No, I don't think he did. Although he did get a haircut around that time, if I remember right, but I'm not sure.
All right. So what we've got this week, and actually my my Google voice is ringing with the wrong numbers that I always get. So I am closing my Gmail window, and that's why I got distracted for a second. I'll explain
what's going on over there.
I always get the same wrong number, and I'll explain it to you after we get off the air. So the big thing this week is Colt Cabana last week released on Howl.fm the first three episodes of his new Pro Wrestling Fringe series, which I co-wrote one of the episodes with him, and I also appear on the second half of it. It's kind of short-form produced storytelling, I guess is what he's calling it. And three different stories. One of them, the one he wrote on his own about Tom McGee, he put up on his Art of Wrestling feed for free this week. And the other ones, I did one about Sputnik Monroe that he reads, and Rob Naylor did one about El Gigante, and those are up on howl.fm, howl as in a wolf howling, howl.fm. And if you want to check it out, use the coupon code Colt for a free month to show them where you're coming from, and that's kind of what you're interested in. And otherwise, you know, just the usual stuff. Figure Four Weekly got something in there this week about Daniel Bryan. And yeah, other than that, as always, Between the Sheets at Place to Be Nation, me and Chris Elner. This week, we looked at 1993 and the, I guess, what should we call it? Resignation, firing, disappearance of Bill Watts from WCW. One of those words.
The filing of Bill Watts.
The defiling of Bill Watts. That's a whole different story. One that we've talked about on a previous episode of Between the Sheets, actually.
I don't think we're going to go into that here right now.
No, we're not. It's late, everybody. And yeah, so we cover that in pretty in-depth. And yeah, everyone, just check that out. Follow me on Twitter at David Bix. Follow Brian on Twitter at...
Great Brian Last.
Yes, I deserved that.
You know, once I have the synthesizer in my hands, I can't stop playing with it. I know I have all sorts of like cool things I could do with this thing, and it's just...
Oh, that was loud. Wow. Well,
we're regular Herbie Hancock over here.
Well, it took 13 weeks, but 605 Super Podcast has jumped the shark.
We've jumped the shark in the last 3 minutes with just the plugs. This is what happens. If you enjoy our show and you've got lots of money and you want to give us a gratuity, you can see our PayPal donation links at the bottom of every show description on the 605pod.com. You can see it there, and you can do whatever you want with your money. And I think we plug just about everything. Well, I feel like I'm forgetting something.
iTunes. Review on iTunes.
Oh, please. It's always the same thing. It's always the iTunes, isn't it? Listen, if you listen to us on iTunes, and even if you don't, if you want to just help out a brother.
If you have an Apple account, yes.
If you have an Apple account, and if you could please leave us a positive review on iTunes, it would certainly help us, and we'd really, really appreciate it. And that's it.
Probably a five-star review. He's being he's not going far enough. Give a five-star review. Don't just give a positive review. Give a five-star review.
Yes. Give a five-star review. This is the Flair Steamboat of podcasts.
I don't think they allow you to do like 4.5. So you can't say, well, it's a match of the year, but it's not quite perfect. No, you have to go to 5. You have to go all the way to 5.
You also can't do negative stars. So
whose podcast is that for?
I could think of a few, but I probably shouldn't name names because you might be friends with some of them.
Until next week.
Until next week, for David Bixenspan, I am the great Brian Last. Tally-ho! Okay, baby. I'm so fine. I'm so fine. I know where it's at. One time. I just do it one time. Do not have to stand here, be criticized, ridiculized, or recouped. I know where it's all at. I can do it just at one time where Elton John, Elvis Presley, Rodney Eastgaven, and Bo Diddley cannot do what I can do. I'm a bitch on Bo Barron's, brother. I'm a motherfucker on wheels. Woo, look out.